Welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks for being here tonight on the big program. We're going to be talking about the attack on workers that continues basically on every front. The wealth class is stepping up the rhetoric with their corporate-controlled media. We'll cut through the noise and the nonsense and talk about what we should be doing to fight on each and every front. A true right to work with livable wages, health security, retirement security, and the dignity of the voice on the job. Kind of like my grandparents fought for. You know, kind of like my grandparents wanted us to have. We'll talk about that. Also, there was a hearing today on Medicaid expansion. We'll get into that personally. I think it's a no-brainer. For anyone who runs around calling himself the more jobs governor, this is a way to go. Yep, brought 30,000 jobs to the state. All I had to do was take a boatload of money that I have no... It just blows the mind. Also going to talk about Temp Job Nation. You know, we hear this call to rebuild manufacturing and bring back jobs. But what kind of jobs are they? Well, what we're finding out is they're low wage, no benefits, poor working conditions, insecure. And you know what? The second you say we're going to try and organize, well, you don't actually work for that company. You work for a third-party logistic or a fourth-party logistic company. Who knows who you work for, and you're out the door. I'm going to talk about all those things and much more, your thoughts, your questions, your comments, whatever's on your mind. If you find yourself in one of those temp jobs, I'd love to hear it. 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Check out the website, therickSmithShow.com. So today is the 50th anniversary of the beginning of the war on poverty put forth by Lyndon Baines Johnson. And, you know, the conservative media today, the corporate-controlled, for-profit conservative media out there say, oh, it's a failure. The war on poverty at 50, despite trillions, Fox News says, poverty won. Despite 50 years on, another one says, victory nowhere in sight. And you could just go down the list. Every one of these conservative pundits, oh, it's a failure. They took money and they wasted money. And, you know, I got to be honest with you. I go back to my childhood. And from my perspective, the war on poverty did what it was supposed to do. It gave opportunity. It gave a chance. To a poor kid growing up, born into a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. Gave me an educational opportunity, made sure that there was some measure of food in the house. May not have been enough to cover the whole month, may not have been enough not to be as nutritious as it should have been, but it was something. Made sure that when I got sick, there was something to help. And you could go back and either fortunately or unfortunately, depending on how you look at it, I remember all of these things. It would be quite easy, and I've said this on the program a number of times, it'd be quite easy for me to say, you know, I'm that Horatio Alger figure. Grew up in poverty, grew up, you know, on the ground that they put the socioeconomic ladder, but somehow through strong moral fortitude and intestinal fiber, I was able to claw my way out of the primordial ooze and slide up the ladder. And I did it all by myself, but no help from anyone. Now, that would be a lie. It wouldn't be remotely close to the truth. But you hear those stories all the time. From people who, you know, much like me, benefited from a number of the Great Society programs, a number of the War on Poverty programs, and got that hand up, got that step onto that first rung on the ladder, and through hard work, through dedication, through some luck, was able to go up a couple of rungs, but by no means can you make an argument that is because of my strong intestinal fortitude? Ridiculous. It was smart investment. It was sound policy. And it was a caring, compassionate society. And it's easy to go back and say, well, we spent a lot of money and it was all a waste. Nonsense. You think of all the people who are like me. And I'm sure there are a lot of me out in the listening audience. I'm sure there's a lot of folks who go, you know what, when I was a kid, We needed food stamps a number of times to get through the end of the month. We needed heating assistance. We needed some of those. We needed Medicaid services when if the kids got sick. We needed help. And there was that helping hand that was there because our government invested in us. And now we're in a position where, you know, we're doing all right. And we're tax-paying citizens. We're productive members of society because of that investment. And all we hear from the radical right of this country and the corporatists that seem to have the loudest megaphone is, oh, it was all a failure. Investing in those people, those people, just a waste of money. Ungrateful, no good for Nix. Ridiculous. And really, I guess, kind of a rewriting of what the history was. It was never meant to be a program of people with their hand out. It was meant to be, and it was, a hand up. You know, what's interesting to me, you go to the 80s when I grew up, and I remember the rhetoric vividly. I remember the Ronald Reagan welfare queen, who they never found, by the way. The welfare queen was a concoction of numerous stories that they were able to mold together to make this fictional character out there so that everyone could go, oh, yeah, that's the one that... And the welfare queen... It was portrayed as, you know, a black woman with 100 kids driving around in a Cadillac, eating steak every night, drinking Dom Perignon, living the high life with furs and diamonds, and which is ludicrous. Anybody who ever grew up in a housing project realizes that didn't exist. What you had were a bunch of poor people who were struggling to make it to the next day, let alone the next week. And, you know, as a kid, I remember going to the cabinets, and I remember there being nothing there. And I remember that school lunch, and I remember the summer times when we would go to Peartus Elementary School, and the line would be there, and we would get a hot lunch in the middle of the summer, even though there was no school. And they would have activities, and you got to learn tennis and all kinds of crafts, all kinds of stuff to keep kids something to be active with, but also some nutrition. And I remember those meals for a lot of those kids, the only hot meal they had all day. We were investing in those kids. And you go back and you think about the war on poverty and the legislation that came out of it. What the legislation that was the war on poverty, the creation of Medicare and Medicaid to make sure that retirees, to make sure that widows and the disabled and you know, kids like me whose parents died would have some basic level of survival. You know, I find it interesting that someone like Paul Ryan, who ran for vice president in 2012, benefited from this program, benefited from the fact when his father passed away, he was able to collect Social Security, which helped him pay for college. Granted, I don't know, and I'm not saying that somebody needs it or doesn't need it, but he was in a whole lot better off position than most of the people, especially the majority of the people in my neighborhood. I find it a bit disingenuous, the people, again, who benefited from it. And this is where I have a very hard time. Because, like I said, it could be easy for me to say, I did it myself, and the guy behind me, I'm going to kick the ladder off the side of the wall so he doesn't get up over it, so I can keep it for myself. Those are the kind of people we got running this country. Hooray for me and screw everybody else. And that came, in my view, right from the Reagan years. Came right from Ronald Reagan and that whole conservative John Birch, William F. Buckley type conservative mentality. You go back to the other pieces of legislation outside of Medicare and Medicaid, the Food Stamp Act of 64 said, you know, we're going to make sure that people have enough to eat. In the wealthiest country in the world, it's ludicrous that people don't have enough to eat in this country. They also passed the Economic Opportunity Act, which created the Job Corps, the VISTA program, federal work study programs, and another bunch of stuff to get people the skills and the job training so that they would have the skills to move into the next job. The sad reality is, in my view, a lot of this stuff has been co-opted by these big corporations who go, hey, lots of free money for us. Also, the Office of Economic Opportunity, they're one of the folks who created Head Start programs. giving kids an opportunity early on, especially in neighborhoods like mine, growing up in poverty. Also part of the war on poverty was the Elementary and Secondary Education Act, which eventually was reauthorized most recently in No Child Left Behind. But it said, you know what, we're going to take some money and we're going to give it to the schools that are struggling the most. Schools like where I would have gone. High poverty rates. Give them the opportunity to get decent books and to get decent facilities. The sad reality is a lot of that was used in the wrong direction. I remember the busing of the 70s, which was idiotic and ridiculous. Just like I think charter schools, where they have gone to this point, is idiotic and ridiculous. I think both ideas at the beginning, making sure that all schools have decent resources and that you have you have teachers and facilities that are just as good in every school. I think that was a laudable goal. But busing the kids to the resources was a horrible idea. You move the resources to the kids. That's what, even as a second, third grader, I saw that. And the charter school thing, I was, I've got to be honest. Laboratories of invention. Okay, let's try some new things. I'm all in favor of it. But not in a profit motive. And definitely not out of the hands of we, the taxpayers. But here's the bottom line in all this. And we could talk about this all night long. For me, it was a smart investment in me. Because over the years, I have paid back the investment that this country made in me. And I know a lot of people who are in the same position who have done the same. That's what it's really all about, in my view. And while you could say, well, we've lost the war on poverty, without the programs that were in place, poverty would be at least double what it is now. And what we should be doing in this next round as we go forward, we should have the second war on poverty. We should have the surge on poverty. You're not going to hear many conservatives saying we should have the surge to eliminate and win the war on poverty, will you? Fox News ain't going to jump on board with that one. I say we increase Social Security. Give people more benefits. Give them better benefits. Increase the earned income tax credit, a very conservative idea. Increase the child tax credit so that we make sure that kids get the nutrition and the opportunity that they need. And, of course, in my view, increase food stamps. That's the start. And then we can talk about a whole bunch of other things. We got a cap on Social Security where we had 199 people in this country on the first day of the year paid everything they're going to pay into it. On day two, we had almost 1,000 people who are never going to pay another dime beyond the first 2 days. I say you scrap the cap of that and you say, you know what? There'll be no cap, but we're going to start that taxing. We're going to start that at about $10,000. In fact, you're not going to pay tax on any money up to whatever we say the minimum to live in this country is, be it $10,000, $15,000, or $20,000. No taxes. And that's for rich people as well. It's for everybody. That's how you stimulate the economy, and that's how I think we fight the war on poverty. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, I'll talk a little bit about what's going on in Harrisburg. This assault on workers' rights, the Koch brothers, the Wall Street types, influencing our politics and, influencing their will. Quick break, right back. Stick around and listen to the Rich Smith Show.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up an important public worker union case later this month, Harris versus Quinn, that could result in another heavy blow to organized labor. Harvard Law professor Benjamin Sachs told Salon.com that if unions in the state of Illinois lose the case, it would devastate home care sector unions' ability to collect dues and to organize. The case is a direct attack on unions from an anti-union group. It targets a very effective tactic that unions like SEC SEIU, Unite Here, and AFSCME are using to organize home care workers. Getting governors to classify taxpayer-funded home health care workers as public employees and then granting them union rights. The case attacks the practice of automatic dues collection. Professor Stocks says the court could rule that these workers are not traditional public employees, so the dues laws don't cover them. But the conservative Supreme Court could also go further, according to Professor Stocks, and rule that it's unconstitutional in the public sector to require union dues for collective bargaining. And that, Professor Stocks says, could convert all public employees nationwide to the so-called right-to-work legal status. And he says if the current dues arrangements are ruled unconstitutional, it would dramatically hinder unions' ability to be vibrant political actors. A nationwide Cambodian garment workers' strike ended Monday following the horrific gunning down of union protesters by Cambodian military police this past Friday. At least four workers were killed, many more wounded, when the military opened fire with assault rifles during a labor protest. The strike started December 24th. Tens of thousands of garment workers were demanding higher wages in Cambodia. Unions wanted $160 a month. An offer of $100 a month was rejected by the workers, and they defied a government order to return to work by January 2nd. Since the military crushed the strike and murdered striking workers, the government has banned further labor protests. The Asia Floor Wage Alliance estimates that a minimum living wage for Cambodian garment workers is $283 a month. Cambodia's garment industry serves the U.S. and European Union markets with an annual estimated profit of more than $5 billion in 2013.
You still fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fed up?
Yeah!
Are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in south side of Chicago, and it's rough. And they don't have a voice, and they're scared to step up and say, like, we need to change things in our neighborhood. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Join our Workers Independent News Solidarity Circle today by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
By working harder and working smarter, working with the employees in the Commonwealth, we made state government the smallest it has been in over 50 years. Promise kept.
We who have nothing, and most likely will too, we all end up locked up in jail. By conservative Christians, right-wing Republicans, straight white American man.
Again, I don't remember that on the campaign trail as one of the promises, but if you can rewrite history, why not? He's attacked public workers and workers in general on every front, so if that's a promise he made to someone in a back room, well, now he's out there saying that, yeah, he kept it. Sad, sad stuff. Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therickssmithshow.com. So what we're seeing is this frontal attack on workers' rights, and it's coming from outside the state. And when we were in Wisconsin back in 2011, sleeping on the marble floor of the Wisconsin State Capitol, I remember broadcasting from inside one of the representatives' office saying, Pennsylvania, wake up, organize now. All of these attacks that are going on in Wisconsin, well, they're going to be coming to us. And they have been. And from what I'm being told, well, they're stepping it up, which is why we've asked our good friend Wendell Young IV. He's the president of UFCW Local 1776 to come talk to us about this most recent piece of legislation that's come to my desk, 1507, amending the Public Employee Relations Act of 1970. Wendell, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, Rick, how you doing? Thanks for actually joining.
I'm good. You know, I'm looking at this, and it's come to my desk that what we're hearing from some Republicans is they want to, and explain this to me, they want to stop allowing the state to collect dues for public workers because it's too expensive. Is this what I'm getting?
Well, that's the one of the things that the wing nuts talk about is that the state shouldn't have to put the cost to deduct the union members' dues of public employees and forward it to the union. They shouldn't be acting as a collection agent for the union. It's very deceptive to refer to it that way. You know, the state of Pennsylvania, the municipalities in Pennsylvania, the school districts, everybody is well into the current century in terms of payroll administration. They have automated payroll systems. Many of them are just exactly like, you know, ADP, paychecks, companies like that. They have, some of them have their own systems. Some have systems they're using. But either way, it's automated. And automated payroll systems all across this country in public and private sector allow people so many deduction slots. You know, if you want to deduct for United Way, if you want to deduct for a bank or a credit union. So having a deduction spot there for your union dues is also part of it. So it's built into the platform. The platform accommodates a whole bunch of deduction slots. It doesn't cost the state or the city or the school district any more money to do that. And what unions here in Pennsylvania do is, as part of the collective bargaining process, just like the health care deductions or the pension deductions, you know, the state also deducts for the, you know, employees' pension contribution, right, the portion they pay in their health care. So just like that, the unions negotiate that the payroll deduction can also be made for union dues. My point is, Rick, there's no expense, there's no economic burden on the taxpayers, on the state, or anybody else.
So then the question that I have then, if it's not what they're telling me, because they're telling me it's just too much money, it's so expensive, if it's not that, then, you know, you go back to, you know, Roman times and Cicero, Cui Bono, you know, who benefits from doing this? If it's not about saving the taxpayers' money, then who's it really benefiting?
Well, the wingnuts led by Darrell Metcalf out in the western part of the state are upset that they have not gotten their agenda through. And who is it that they believe is blocking their agenda? Well, the labor movement, in a very organized fashion, has done a great job bringing to light the problems with the ultra-conservative wingnut agenda. And they're pissed off that they're not getting their way on everything they want to do. So what do? You defund and silence the people who are crying foul and calling you on the carpet to be accountable for what you're trying to do. So that's all they're trying to do, is to silence workers, silence their unions by defunding them. They know that if they can get some of these measures passed that would prohibit the state or the municipalities or the school districts, any public entities, from entering into agreements to deduct those dues, that it will reduce the funding to the unions and therefore make it harder for the unions to be a voice on behalf of working families and show these people for what they really are, ultra-conservative wing nuts that are out to do the work of the corporations, of the conservative groups like the Commonwealth Foundation, of the Koch brothers, and folks of that ilk. And that's all this is about. That's all this is about.
So when we talk to people, because look, I mean, it sounds like an issue that you know most people gloss over. It's in the weeds. For me, at the end of it, it seems to me that this is nothing more than retaliation. This is nothing more than we have the power, well, to crush you, and we're going to use the big money from the special interest to do it.
Hey, you're right, because if they really were worried about how people's money are being used. First of all, you know, if you're a union member, you have to sign authorizations for those kind of deductions. When you first become a member, just like you have to sign one for a bank deduction and other things, and you know, we all do that in the labor movement administratively. You get to vote for your union officials, you get to vote for your labor contract, and you actually have the right as a public employee to opt out of your union. You still have to pay a fee in Pennsylvania if you opt out of your union, because the law also requires the union to represent all of those workers and do the job for them, and they have to be compensated with all the benefits that the union contract brings. So, the workers have lots of different ways to deal with this issue, so there's no issue that workers are pushing this. This is being pushed by conservative groups like the Commonwealth Foundation, by the Koch brothers and different groups like Freedom Works, by, you know, Darrell Metcalf, those kind of people. And it's not being done because you have, masses of union members out there saying, you know, we need this, to protect our paychecks. That's just nonsense. This is being funded by conservatives and corporations you know, if they were really interested in fairness, they would be arguing that publicly traded companies would have to do the same thing, that they wouldn't be allowed to use their monies for political purposes. You know, shareholders buy shares of companies, and they may vote on different initiatives, but they don't make the decisions about whether they're going to contribute some of that money to the Commonwealth Foundation or other similar groups, and, you know, which issues they're going to lobby for or not lobby for. I mean, this is just singling out labor unions to silence them. That's all this is about.
Yeah, and another thing that bothers me in this is it's basically making it illegal for an employee and the employer to sit down and negotiate a contract and come to an agreement. They're, you know, for the people who say that we want government out of your life and we want less intrusive government, this seems like a major intrusion.
You're absolutely right, because think about it. They're only going after the dudes, right? The labor union also negotiates over how much, if any, people are going to pay for their health care and their pensions. And not always the pensions. Sometimes that's a matter of state law. But the union negotiates over, I'm talking about the employee portion of the pension and the health care contribution.
Right.
And the union also negotiates over, is that money going to be deducted from the paychecks or not? How is it going to be paid? And, you know, what's the frequency of the payment, the amount of the payment, all that kind of stuff. And they're not talking about stopping that. And the union also negotiates the right for workers to have payroll deduction for personal banking or for United Way or for, the credit union, like the Pennsylvania State Employee Credit Union. You know, nowhere in this legislation is saying that you're not going to be allowed to make deductions for employees that belong to the Pennsylvania State Employee Credit Union. They're not saying that, are they?
No.
This is only geared to silence unions because the ultra-conservative, tea-banger, wing-nuts are upset that they're not getting everything they want out of this governor and this legislature. And they have a scapegoat in the unions because we go to Harrisburg and we get on shows like this, Rick, and we, you know, take out commercials and we lobby and we point out the problems with their agenda, and everybody doesn't agree with them, so they want to silence us.
So at the end of the day,
we're the loudest voice against their agenda.
So at the end of the day, the message away from this is just, this is just basically Machiavellian retribution.
Well, I guess you could use the term Machiavellian. I'm not sure that they're that clever. It's pretty obvious what they're trying to do.
Let me ask you another question then, because, you know, the other thing that gets me, Wendell, is we hear about government being wasting money, waste, fraud, and abuse, and we hear conservatives saying we're good stewards of the taxpayer dollar. And I look at Governor Corbett's scheme to privatize the lottery, where we spent millions of dollars, I would say wasted millions of dollars, trying this scheme. How much are we spending pushing this corporate agenda to attack workers and really to do things that nobody is calling for other than the very well-to-do in this country?
Well, you raise a great point. I don't recall what the price tag's up to now, the state paid. I think just the legal fees alone are close to $50 million on the lottery deal. I'm sure there's a whole lot of other expenses. You know, there's an expense in having all these administrative staff people. You know, there's some portion of their time, therefore their total compensation, and, you know, the whole operation of government. A certain amount of the overhead was dedicated to this multi-year, you know, folly to do the lottery. And the same with the liquor privatization. You know, you've got things like the voter ID bill. You know, it can't produce one case of voter fraud based on ID. Yet what's the government now spent here in Pennsylvania? Several hundred million dollars,
yeah.
In not only the legal fees, but all the money to explain to voters over and over again what they did or didn't do, and how it's supposed to work and the defense of it and the arguments. I mean, it's hundreds of millions of dollars.
Yeah, well, just $1 million.
Nobody's screaming accountability for that.
Yeah, just $1 million before the last election to promote a law that's not even in place yet. I kept telling people, you need an ID, but it might be coming. Don't worry about it. We're going to waste your money anyway. And I guess I got to be honest. I don't know that I would be upset if times were good, if we were funding education fully, if we were taking care of the least vulnerable in our society, if our roads and our bridges were state-of-the-art and we had broadband access and public transportation and all of the things that this governor has defunded, maybe I wouldn't be as upset, but I got to be honest, like many people, I'm ticked off at this guy.
Yeah, well, and clearly that's a good reason his poll numbers are where they are, so no surprise there.
You brought up the wine and spirit shops, and I wanted to finish up with this because, you know, I understand this is like the lottery, maybe still on the table. They still want to steal the wine and spirit shops. And help me walk through this, the history of this, because I remember at the beginning of it, they threw out this eye-popping number of $2 billion, and then by the time you got down to it, it was a couple hundred million, and then it wasn't even about the money. It was some of the core functions of government or nonsense.
Rick, it's worse than that. If you go back a little more than 3 years ago to when the conservatives shored up both houses of the legislature and won the governor's seat, Mike Terzi announced immediately after the election. And remember, back then, we were looking at a multi-billion dollar state budget deficit as a result of the recession and the impact of the recession. Like a lot of states, you know, we were not unique. Budget deficit of billions of dollars, and Mike Terzi announced very publicly, it's all in print, that we could sell the liquor stores for $6 billion.
Wow.
And not only close the back then numbers anywhere from, depending who you talk to, $2.5 to $4 billion deficit were being bounced around, and he was absolutely convinced $6 billion. So as the debate raged going into January of 2011, he started to back off that number, and he started to back down and say it was about $4 to $6 billion. Then it was about $3 or $4 billion. Then eventually, by the winter was starting to defrost in 2011, he was saying maybe $2 billion net. And then eventually, it became clear that there wasn't a multi-billion-dollar windfall for the state. And the real clinker for Terzi was when the governor's own study in 2011 came out and said that the likely take would be significantly lower depending on which track they took, how they did it, and numbers more like $1 billion or $800 million. But also in the study showed that there were hundreds of millions of dollars in costs associated with winding the system down. And then as they further studied it, testimony was brought forward by, you know, people in the field, it became clear that they weren't going to get any windfall. That in the best case scenario, they might get 350 to 500 or 600 million, but there was still that $400 million price tag to unwind the current system and other costs associated with unwinding the system that were not studied in the governor's consultant study. So we were actually looking at losing money. And Terzi, by 2012, was saying to people, it doesn't matter if we make money or not, because this is a philosophical issue. And you know, when people lead with philosophy, that it's about philosophy, it's because they can't win the argument on the merits of the facts. And it had become clear to everybody in the building by mid-2011 that they weren't going to be able to close a budget deficit, that there wasn't going to be a windfall up front, and that the system is making money compared to Terzi saying it was losing money, and it was not a failed system. In fact, the trajectory is upward, and it continues to make more money every year. We've been debating this. Record profits, record tax collections, record sales. He said that we had a system that the product costs more money with lower selection than other states, and that's absolutely been proven untrue, that we have better pricing than every one of our border states and better selection. The only exception is the state of Delaware, and all consumer goods in Delaware are cheaper than Pennsylvania and will be if you were to privatize liquor still, because they don't tax consumer goods in Delaware on anything.
Right.
So whether it's electronics or liquor or anything else. There's no taxes, and unless Pennsylvania is going to eliminate all the taxes on liquor, we'll never beat Delaware. And once, you know, we've been very vocal about this, and we've spent a lot of money on this, and it ties back to what I said earlier about trying to defund us. If you go to the Commonwealth Foundation's website right now, I guess I should be flattered. They have a video about this paycheck protection, as they call paycheck protection, we call paycheck deception. They have a video, and I'm the main villain in their video. Why is that? Because my members have chosen to fight. My members have chosen to take a stand, and they, and you know, with the people I work with on behalf of those members and with those members, we've spent a lot of time in Harrisburg fighting this privatization, showing the flaws in Mike Terzai's comments and the governor's comments, showing that the system actually makes money, great selection, lower prices, good jobs, doesn't cause taxpayers to pay anything. It actually makes money for the taxpayers, and they're pissed off about that. So they want to silence us, and they want to do it by taking away the money that we use to expose their lies.
So what do we do to stop this? I mean, I outside of election time, throwing the bums out, what do we do?
Well, you know, you're right. We have to throw them out. We have a great opportunity to get rid of the wing nuts. And you know, I'm not going to suggest, you know, you just got to, you know, elect all Democrats to get rid of all Republicans. But in this case, we definitely need a Democratic governor. There is no options on the Republican side because there's too many weenies out there that won't take on corporate, even though they don't like themselves. Out of party loyalty, we've got a great field of Democratic candidates for governor. The good thing is there's a lot of really good people, which means we'll have a great discussion and conversation about, you know, the issues that are important to working families. But the problem is there's a lot of Democrats in the field, and that's going to use up a lot of resources trying to decide which one of those will survive and make it through the primary. They're all good people, though. I have a great deal of respect for all of them. Our union has endorsed Rob McCord. You know, we're certainly going to do everything we can to advance this campaign. I think you get a good governor in there, in this case a Democrat, to bring a reasoned conversation back to Harrisburg. And you also have half the Senate up for reelection and the entire House. And I think you have to look at the wingnuts, the people who are responsible for the paralysis in government in terms of the legislative process, are the same kind of people that are causing the same problem in other states in Washington, D.C., and you got to get rid of them.
Yeah, the Stephen Blooms of the world, the Cutlers, the Metcalfs.
You got to get rid of the extremists on the right, and so that people, you know, there are reasonable people in both parties that would like to see some good things done. They would have liked to have avoided wasting the time on this lottery folly, on the liquor folly. You know, there's great things that the legislature could do to allow the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board to do a better job. You know, if you listen to Mike Terzai, what he doesn't like about the Pennsylvania Liquor Control Board, he's responsible for it. You know, as the leader of the House, he's been blocking the legislative efforts that would bring changes to the law that would allow the liquor stores to be more consumer responsive. He won't do it. He's standing in the way. So if you get rid of the crazy, the reasonable people in both parties, I think, will sit down and solve a lot of problems, improve our jobs picture in Pennsylvania, get Medicaid expansion so that, you know, those people that don't have health care, need health care, want health care, can get a subsidy through the Affordable Care Act, otherwise known as Obamacare. Right now, Pennsylvania, unfortunately, you know, if you're at the lower end of the economic spectrum in terms of your salary and you need to get your benefits through the federal exchange, you won't get a subsidy like people who make more money will because our governor chose not to expand Medicaid.
Right.
You know, we need to get rid of the crazies, and that starts with Corbett and a handful of those others.
That starts right at the top. Wendell Young, it's always great having you on the program. I appreciate you taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks for inviting me.
Thanks so much. Quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. What do you think of all this? Right back.
Save the USA. Drowning in crafty lies. Save the USA. And resume the ties it binds. Stop taking all our money and shipping it offshore. Do the job you're looking for.
saving work in America, one show at a time. The Rick Smith Show.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for The Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at TheRickSmithShow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can and we will rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Tenacity can be a virtue. But the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then, they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
There are many employers that say, you know, we're looking for people, but we can't find anybody that has passed the drug test, a lot of them. And that's a concern for me, because we're having a serious problem with that.
Go, go, go. I messed up my entire life because I got high. Go. I lost my kids and wife because I got high.
Say what?
Now I'm sleeping on the sidewalk, and I know why.
Why, man?
Yeah, because I got high. Because I got high.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. A couple of quick emails. Albert sent me an email saying, why doesn't Fox News talk much about the money spent on the war on drugs, plus whether we've won or not, and talking about my first segment of the war on poverty and the conservative right and Fox News going nuts. And you're right, Albert. You know, we never hear much about that. Also, Thomas writes, Rick, it's amazing how much BS comes out of the mouth of Mike Terzai. Isn't he the guy that said something about voter ID being done so Romney could win? He says, thank goodness we didn't privatize our liquor stores. I've lived in states where there was a liquor store on every corner. Bad stuff. Thanks for what you do. I've been to those places where, you know, you've got a liquor store at every corner, and, you know, liquor, go to Washington, D.C. You got liquor and dry cleaning, liquor and sandwiches. It permeates the society. And Bill writes me, I don't know if you saw this, but New York Governor Mario Cuomo announced that they are going to be going after authorizing the use of medical marijuana. Why won't Tom Corbett join along? And, you know, given the fact that, you know, they want a liquor store on every corner, you know, medical marijuana, why not? But the governor had a spokesman, this Jay Pagney, Corbett spokesman, said, yeah, the governor would be open to it, with direction from the Food and Drug Administration. Pagny says, if in fact the FDA does deem there are appropriate and medical uses, there's something that the governor would obviously take into consideration. He'd be open to direction, and the FDA is the agency for that direction. What I find interesting, and maybe it's just me, I do find it kind of interesting that you have an ideologue who is anti-government. That whole right-wing movement, do away with the FDA, do away with the EPA, do away with all those regulatory agencies. And now, you know, don't you think it's kind of a cop-out for an ideologue that's big on, you know, we don't want big government telling me what to do, and now he wants direction from that big government agency? Just kind of a thought. But I do want to go back over the wine and spirit shop thing, because Wendell reminded me of something that I had forgotten. I had forgotten Terzai said $6 billion. You know, I remember the Tinky Tank, the Commonwealth Foundation, and their numbers, which was $2 billion. And then it kept going down as you kept seeing what it was. As you saw it for what it was a ripoff. It was a theft. Like most privatization schemes. Yet, I've been doing this program 8 years now. Often, I ask, show me something we've privatized that is done better, cheaper, and benefits we the people. Now, I know when we privatize stuff, it does better for the people that get it, the investor class. But what about the rest of us? And I said that about the wine and spirit shops. It's kind of silly to me, given all of the money that comes into the state coffers, given the fact that it's a system that, you know, when I, as an adult, if I want something, I know where it is. It's there for me to go get. Pretty simple. Can we do a couple things a little differently, modernize a little bit? Sure, probably. I would, and I think most of the people in this state want to be able to buy a six-pack. I think the vast majority of people. I think the wine and spirit stuff, people know where that stuff's at. But I think Joe Sixpack wants to drive home from work after a hard day and swing by somewhere and pick up just a six-pack. You don't want to have to buy a whole case. I think that's a logical first step. And there are so many things we could be doing. Same thing with the lottery. If you want Keno, run it through the legislative process, let them do it. And let the benefits come to the state. Whatever. You do what you got to do. But don't throw it out there and say, oh, yeah, we're going to give you this, too. I mean, think about what this governor has done. Think of the proposals that the people in power of this state, because understand, the Democrats have no voice. Everything that has either happened or not happened is because of the Republicans. And the bad stuff, that really bad stuff that hasn't happened, is because you do have some moderate Republicans who have said, man, that's really crazy. Don't do that. Pretty simple to me. Anyway, when we come back, I'm going to talk a little bit about the minimum wage. Interesting, again, you know, talk about fake news on Fox. Interesting statement by Arthur Laffer, which is kind of a joke. The name, anyway. The guy who brought us the Laffer curve. We're going to talk about his latest comic. Quick break, right back. Stick around. You listen to The Rick Smith Show.
In an ocean of red, Rick Smith.
Would you dive 14 feet deep in the Susquehanna to keep a bridge safe? Would you spend night after night with prisoners to keep your community safe? Would you spend Christmas Eve plowing snow to keep roads safe? AFSCME members do. Men and women who choose to serve in public service. Mine inspectors, 911 dispatchers, healthcare workers, parole agents. You may not think about them, but no, they're all thinking about you. This message brought to you by AFSCME Council 13.
In 1897, miners at collieries throughout northeastern Pennsylvania's anthracite coal region had enough. Conditions were grueling and life was difficult. Miners were frequently cheated out of pay, overcharged for supplies, some they never wanted or received, forced to live in captive company-owned towns, shop at overpriced company-owned stores, even mandated to use the company doctor since fees were deducted automatically from the miner's pay. This, combined with mine owners forcing longer unpaid hours and the Anti-Immigrant Campbell Act of 1898, 1897, taxing mine owners for the use of non-native labor, drove miners to strike. Spontaneously starting in Pennsylvania's Lehigh Valley, workers marched north to get other miners to join in the struggle. Their demands were modest, a 10-cent pay raise and a reduction in the cost of gunpowder. They also wanted the freedom to shop in non-company-owned stores of their choosing and see a doctor not owned by the coal company. As the miners moved northward toward Hazleton, mine owners, determined to crush the workers' protest, sent their company-paid police force and strikebreakers. Local law enforcement was also on the side of mine owners. Luzerne County Sheriff James Martin, a former mine foreman, deputized 102 local men, arming them with Winchester rifles and sidearms. The group of some 400 miners marching peacefully and unarmed in rows of fours moved onward toward Latimer. Stephen Urich, joining the group outside of Hazleton, taking with him the American flag, shouted, "We have nothing to worry about because we have the American flag to protect us." Within hours and a hail of Winchester bullets, Stephen Urich was gunned down in cold blood, his beloved American flag drenched in his blood and the blood of those who lay murdered and wounded. Eyewitnesses said the sheriff and his hired killers mowed the men down like grass. More than 20 men were murdered on that September day, and more than 50 were wounded, many shot in the back in labor's forgotten massacre. The sheriff and his murderous band were tried for their part in the Latimer massacre and found not guilty of murdering 20 unarmed peaceful demonstrators. Lest we never forget, or as the wife of a miner whose life was stolen from him told her children, "You can forgive, but you can't forget." This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment was made possible by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, visit www.ricksmithshow.com.
United we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. So, fake news on Fox had one of their normal guests, this Arthur Laffer. If you may remember Arthur Laffer, he was the a Reagan era economist. The guy who came up with the we need to have lower taxes. He came up with the Laffer curve, which, 100% of taxes means no government money coming in, and of course, this idea if you have zero taxes, there'll be zero money coming in, and he kind of skewed the curve to make it look like, hey, if you lowered taxes, and you got more people paying, bring money in, and we'd have more tax revenue, which for a very short period of time actually worked until you went back to giving all the loopholes out. Because the tax reform bill of 86, well, it closed the loopholes, lowered the rates an enormous amount, and then gave the loopholes all back without raising the rates, which is how we've created this massive billionaire class. It's that simple. Anyway, he was on fake news, and he said that Congress should repeal the federal minimum wage. Repeal the minimum wage. Oh, it's, as he called it, the Black Teenage Unemployment Act. Yeah, he says it makes no sense whatsoever to have the minimum wage. He says, honestly, it's just the Black Teenage Unemployment Act. And this is the very group that we need to have jobs, not to be put out of work because of a minimum wage. He says, so I'm very much in favor of, at least for teenagers, getting rid of the minimum wage. The think tank, the American Enterprise Institute, funded by the very well-to-do, the people who have never missed a meal, their resident scholar, a guy named Michael Strain, he jumped in, said that the minimum wage should be lowered to $4 an hour for the long-term unemployed, because companies, they should want to take a chance on those people. 7.25 on somebody who's been alive, that's a lot of money. We can't possibly do that. We should have, $4 an hour, they go, well, how much lower do you want to go? How about $1? How about 50 cents? How about cheese crackers? I mean, where do you set the floor? I mean, if you've got the ludicrous from the right saying, well, if you're going to raise it to 15, why not just 100? Well, nobody's asking for that. But you do know that the folks, the American Enterprise is asking for, the American Enterprise answer, they're $4. And I'm sure we can find a right-wing think tank out there who will say cheese crackers would be just enough. Cheese crackers would be a high enough wage. And not the store, not the brand name either, the store brand. And you got to ask the question, you know, at what point does it end? How low, you know, how low will you go? If you remember, there are states across the country who have used prison labor. You go back through our history. In fact, when we were in Tennessee, there was actually an uprising 100 and some years ago where they were using convict labor in the mines. Basically what they were doing is they were taking former slaves. They were trumping up charges, convicting them, throwing them in jail, saying, you got two choices. You can rot here in jail and we won't feed you. We can put you in the mines. You can work for free and at least you'll get something to eat. And the white miners who lost their jobs because, hey, I can't afford to work for just bread and water, said, enough of that. And oddly enough, last year, back when the uprising happened 100 and some years ago, and they killed a number of the miners, they signed a treaty with the dead miners saying it was the miners' fault. Gotta love that. But, you know, you hear these voices keep popping up. We need a lower minimum wage. You need a starter wage. Well, I think, you know, 7.25, that's pretty bottom of the line. You know, we're using prison labor. We're using, there was even a thought of what we'll do. If I remember this, and Obama actually came up with it as well. And a number of southern states were already doing it. They were taking unemployed people and giving them to employers. Here, take them. Let them work for free. And we'll pay the unemployment. And you go, well, that sounds like a reasonable idea, except what it ends up happening is you've got the law of unintended consequences where you end up putting people who were working in those jobs and making money and supporting their families, they end up unemployed. So when I talk about full employment policies and government being the employer of last resort, I'm talking about stuff that we're not doing. There's a lot of stuff that we're not doing. That we could be doing, especially when you're talking about senior care, when you're talking about helping seniors. You know, I think about my grandmother who, you know, every time I go back to Cleveland to visit, she's always going, you know, there's this needs to be done. Can you do this? Can you do that? Well, you know what? Maybe we do like the city that my grandparents lived in before the new mayor took over and destroyed it all. Have a team of people who go around and help seniors. You know, the city that my grandmother lives in, if you're a senior that lives alone, they'll come and shovel your driveway in the wintertime. They have people who'll come out, if you need something done, they'll come out and help you. That's what government's supposed to be about. And to me, I think you can put a lot of people to work doing those kind of things, and it would make society a whole lot better. And make things a whole lot better, don't you? You'd give people the dignity of work. You'd give them some skills. Give them a reason to wake up in the morning. Because I got to tell you, I remember being unemployed. Even if it was, you know, 6, 10, 12 weeks, it was depressing as hell. Getting at the end going, am I ever going to find a job? I cannot imagine, honestly, 99 weeks unemployed. I feel for the folks. Anyway, we're going to take a quick break. When we come back, hour two of the program, stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Not right wing. Just right. The Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up an important public worker union case later this month, Harris versus Quinn. It could result in another heavy blow to organized labor. Harvard Law professor Benjamin Sachs told Salon.com that if unions in the state of Illinois lose the case, it would devastate home care sector unions' ability to collect dues and to organize. The case is a direct attack on unions from an anti-union group. It targets a very effective tactic that unions like SEIU, Unite Here,
and AFSCME are using to organize home care workers. Getting governors to classify taxpayer-funded home health care workers as public employees and then granting them union rights. The case attacks the practice of automatic dues collection. Professor Stocks says the court could rule that these workers are not traditional public employees, so the dues laws don't cover them. But the conservative Supreme Court could also go further, according to Professor Stocks, and rule that it's unconstitutional in the public sector to require union dues for collective bargaining. And that, Professor Stocks says, could convert all public employees nationwide to the so-called right-to-work legal status. And he says if the current dues arrangements are ruled unconstitutional, it would dramatically hinder unions' ability to be vibrant political actors. A nationwide Cambodian garment workers' strike ended Monday following the horrific gunning down of union protesters by Cambodian military police this past Friday. At least four workers were killed, many more wounded, when the military opened fire with assault rifles during a labor protest. The strike started December 24th. Tens of thousands of garment workers were demanding higher wages in Cambodia. Unions wanted $160 a month. An offer of $100 a month was rejected by the workers, and they defied a government order to return to work by January 2nd. Since the military crushed the strike and murdered striking workers, the government has banned further labor protests. The Asia Floor Wage Alliance estimates that a minimum living wage for Cambodian garment workers is $283 a month. Cambodia's garment industry serves the U.S. and European Union markets with an annual estimated profit of more than $5 billion in 2013.
You still fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fed up?
Yeah!
Are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough. And they don't have a voice, and they're scared to step up and say, like, we need to change things in our neighborhood. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Join our Workers Independent News Solidarity Circle today by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Texas is a right-to-work state. Texas is a great state.
Well, pardon me if I don't shift.
We could be the Texas of the Northeast.
They're selling make-believe and we don't buy that here. Cause in the real world they're shutting Detroit down. While the boss man takes his bonus pay, jets on out of town. DC's bailing out the bankers as a farmer's auction ground. Yeah, while they're living it up on Wall Street in that New York City town. Here in the real world, they're shutting Detroit down.
I know it was over the Marcellus Shale. They were, we could be just like Texas. We could do all this drilling. Drill, baby, drill. And, you know, part of me goes, maybe we should be the Texas of the Northeast when I look at this story. This 19-year-old girl found a rash on her leg. Decides gotta go to the hospital, get it looked at. Turns out she's got a tumor in her leg. Huge blood clot. They do CAT scans. They do MRIs. She's got a tumor. She doesn't have health insurance. Her parents don't have health insurance. Nobody in the family's got health insurance. This restaurant owner, the guy that she works for, is selling the restaurant that she works at in the hopes that they can get this girl health care. And you ask yourself, what are we doing? In the richest country in the world, this girl, quite frankly, could die because she doesn't have health insurance. Just because you've got a governor like Rick Perry and you've got a governor like Tom Corbett, who won't expand the Medicaid expansion, take the Medicaid expansion money. It's infuriating, which is why I understand there was a hearing today by the House Democratic Policy Committee on the Medicaid expansion, which is why we've asked Representative Pam DeLisio to come talk to us. Pam, thanks for taking time for us.
You're welcome, Rick. My pleasure to be with you this evening.
You know, I look at this story of this 19-year-old girl. You know, it could have been any of us. Could have been any of our kids. Could have been any of us at that time in life. A little rash on the leg, finds out it's got a blood clot, now a tumor, no insurance. It's mind-blowing to me that in the richest country in the world, we don't have a national health care system.
It is. And the policy committee of the Democratic Caucus indeed had a hearing on Medicaid expansion today. In fact, it was my pleasure to co-host it here in the 194th, which I represent part of Philadelphia and Montgomery County. And we heard a variety of testimony, not only from healthcare experts, but also from those citizens and constituents who themselves are adversely affected by the fact that Pennsylvania has yet to opt into Medicaid expansion. And these are folks who are working and can't access health insurance.
So what kind of things did you hear today? I mean, you know, I know there are a number of experts that you talk to, but I like the stories of people like this young woman who, you know, when you're 19, you don't think you're going to have a tumor. You don't think you're going to need health insurance. I'm curious what kind of things you hear when you go out and do these hearings and when you talk to people.
Well, we heard very specific situations from some people about, you know, where they are below the income level that would allow them to qualify for a subsidy, and they're in that gray area between 100 and 138% of poverty, where they're excluded from traditional Medicaid but don't have enough to qualify for the subsidy, and therefore they're left out literally uncovered. They're left uncovered and would be forced to pay out of pocket, which, of course, is not a reasonable expectation and not a practical expectation. So we are putting our citizens at risk. I mean, last Friday I testified at the hearings that the Department of Public Welfare was holding on the Healthy Plan PA that the governor's put forth, including the waiver for how he would like to see Pennsylvania go forth with Medicaid expansion. And my one question and comment was, there's absolutely no reason why we can't opt into Medicaid very directly and then still have these other issues that the governor is interested in addressing that. And at that point, we were 60 hours into the new year. Literally tens of thousands of Pennsylvania citizens could have been covered at that point. And instead, we're at the beginning of this dialogue with the Fed in the hope that some of this waiver may go through. And quite frankly, Arkansas and Iowa and Michigan have shown us many parts of what's included in the Pennsylvania waiver have already been disallowed by the Fed.
So do you think this is, because, you know, I look at a lot of things this governor does. It seems to be stall and delay, much like the Republican plan anyway. Do you think that this is just to throw it out there to make it look like you're doing something, knowing that it's not going to pass? Because, look, to me, if you really wanted to get this, a year ago would have been when you would have put this plan forth so that you don't harm people. You know, I'm thinking of all the people who are going to be hurt because this governor made a clear, conscious choice not to move forward sooner, and really to kind of muck it up.
Right. Well, the governor and I were both sworn in just a short couple of weeks apart back in 2011. Medicaid expansion has certainly been on my radar screen, as well as many of my colleagues since that time, and we have actively been discussing this within the House, and as you may recall, the General Assembly came very, very close to passing Medicaid expansion back in June. The Senate staff had worked out language with the governor's office. It was passed by the Senate, overwhelmingly passed by the Senate, came to the House, and the House Rules Committee stripped that out of one of the welfare code bills, which are part of the budget package. And we tried a very unique procedural move on the floor to try to get that reinstated. Unfortunately, it was defeated, but it was for not lack of effort.
So walk me through this, because, you know, as I'm looking at this, it seems to me, and what I know, and look, you're much deeper into this, and I'm sure have a much greater knowledge of it than I have, but it seems to me on the surface that this is a no-brainer. This is something you take because it's good for the citizens, it's good for the Commonwealth, it's good for job creation, and it's not going to cost us anything for the next couple of years. It just seems like a no-brainer to me.
Well, you're absolutely correct. The state of Pennsylvania is losing an opportunity of somewhere in the vicinity of $8 to $10 million per day that we haven't opted in to this, because for the first 3 years it would be 100% covered by federal money, and after that it goes down to the feds would continue to pay 90%, the state would be paying 10%. Three very independent studies, the Rand Group, the Independent Fiscal Office, and another group that immediately escaped my mind, both produced studies with extremely similar results, saying that the jobs created would be in the somewhere in the 25,000 to 35,000 range. There's a lot of jobs all in and around the healthcare sector as a result of this. Folks would be covered, and it would bring in a lot of federal money. So I am at a loss as to why somebody wouldn't proceed, and the concerns that it's not sustainable and that the feds could renege at some point is covered by the fact that the state can opt out as easily as they opt in at any time. So there is no reason why, in my mind, why somebody wouldn't opt in, particularly since you can just opt out. Yeah. And I think the concern about opting out is then how do they tell people they'll no longer have coverage? So the answer to that is not offering them coverage at all.
Well, I mean, telling people
that doesn't make any sense.
Well, I mean, this governor doesn't have a problem with telling people who had coverage that they no longer do. If you go back to right when he took office, he kicked 41,000 people off of adult basic. Then, you know, not too long after that, 89,000 kids off the CHIP program. He doesn't have any problem with that. Opting back out, I don't see to be a problem. I think this is just an ideological thing. He was one of the first people to sign on to the lawsuit against the Affordable Care Act, and I think he's still a bit chafed. And ideologically, the people who are paying for his campaign, they don't want it.
That has been the discussion of some speculation. Obviously, I'm not in the governor's shoes nor in his head, so I can't speak for him. But from where I sit, one has to wonder that this isn't being driven by a commitment to an ideology that is not does not best serve the majority of the citizens of Pennsylvania. And, you know, I've looked at this. I've looked at these reports. You know, yes, there's an additional 10% commitment on the heart of the state after those initial 3 years. However, what we would get back in return in terms of payroll taxes collected, you know, new businesses coming into being, et cetera, you know, puts the net positive on this particular project. It's not a net negative.
And for the rest of us, I mean, for everybody else that's insured, it's my view that at some point, once you get everybody insured, you no longer have people using the ER as their primary care physician. You no longer have people using the most expensive delivery system. Then I think the rates come down for everybody, and I think it's a good economic stimulus as the mass of people throughout the state end up having a buck or two more in their pocket.
I agree. And the fact that people would be generally healthier, more productive, less opportunity to perhaps miss work, you know, it's important that we do an emphasis on wellness prevention. The Affordable Care Act offers those opportunities beyond a doubt. And there are, quite honestly, stories that we heard today which are not isolated stories. This is what's being heard every hour of every day in Pennsylvania of those who can't access care because they fall into that gray area. They would have been covered if we had opted in for Medicaid expansion, and if we continue to pursue the path we're on, it would be 2015 at the earliest.
Wow.
And we have been kissed off all of those dollars in 2014. This is 3 years worth of 100%, but it's for the years 2014, 2015, and 2016. It's not 3 years from when you opt in. So literally, we have lost, this is the 8th of January, we've lost somewhere in the neighborhood of, you know, $75 to $80 million.
Just right there, what you said right there is the reason not to reelect this guy. In my view, I just, along with all of the plethora of other things, the long laundry list of other things, that right there to me is right up on the top. You're listening to the Rick Smith Show here with State Representative Pam DeLisio. You know, Pam, today being the 50th anniversary of the Declaration of War on Poverty, if you will, I believe we need to be redoubling our effort to raise those in poverty up and rebuild a prosperous working class in this country. And to me, it comes down to smart policy. I think we should be increasing the minimum wage. I think we should be getting people health security through whatever way we can get them insurance. And, you know, expand other things like Social Security and earned income tax credits and a lot of the other stuff. But I'm just not, I don't see the appetite there yet. Do you see, like, especially on the minimum wage, do you see there's some momentum building in the House, at least on the Democratic side, to get something done?
Well, the bill was introduced within the last 6 to 8 weeks for increasing the minimum wage. Personally, I have not signed on to that yet. I've had discussions with the prime sponsor of that bill, Patty Kim, particularly as it pertains to her time frame of implementation date, which would be effective 60 days after it were to become law, which is not a lot of lead time to give some employers almost a 21% increase in their payroll. So for me, that and Representative Kim was very amenable to taking into consideration those types of things. I'd also like to see this tied to an index.
Yes.
So that we're not seeing just a jump from now, $7.25 to $9, and subsequently in another, whatever it is, 18 months after that, to $10 or 10-something, but tied to an indicator so we don't have to constantly revisit this, and this becomes a political football. That needs to happen, and again, it's fairly well documented that going down this path allows those dollars to come back into the economy, and that's a good thing and a positive thing. These are the same folks who earn these lower wages, who cannot participate, who still, have to depend on other safety net programs in order to feed their families and sometimes heat their homes and meet just the bare minimum necessities. They would like to be more independent that way, and the way to do that is by paying somebody a sustainable wage.
Yep.
We don't do that. I've run four companies in 30 years. We've always paid people a sustainable wage and then some. It's very important.
I'm right there with you. Representative DeLisio, it's great talking with you. I appreciate you taking time for us. I look forward to having you come back again and talk to us again.
My pleasure, Rick. Thank you so much.
Thanks so much. Let's take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425. This is the Rick Smith Show. For working people, come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
This is the Media Matters Minute. I'm John Kerr. On the 50th anniversary of Lyndon Johnson's War on Poverty, Fox Business host Stuart Varney dismissed anti-poverty programs as ineffective. Varney, who has repeatedly mocked low-income Americans, ignores widespread evidence that government programs have been vital in decreasing the poverty rate.
We have not made that much progress in reducing the poverty rate. 15% of Americans are still in poverty. It's roughly the same level as it was back in 1964. It did help feed hungry people, treat sick people, and it did raise the standard of living for many, many poor people. However, the proportion of people still living in poverty, pretty much the same as it was back in 1964.
These federal programs that Varney discounts have actually been crucial in reducing the poverty rate during the past 50 years. According to a recent study by the Columbia Population Research Center at Columbia University, government programs today are cutting poverty rates nearly in half. Without these programs, poverty rates in the United States today would be at around 29%. For more on this and other stories, please visit MediaMatters.org.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand-name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then, they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group, That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Exposing GOP half-truths, lies, and hypocrisy every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Rick Smith.
Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Everything's raisin, but the weight is. Yes, like groceries and our haters. Everything's raisin, but the weight is.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, therichsmithshow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, you can download the podcast there at the website or get the Stitcher app on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Interesting. One of these story caught my attention, made me laugh. And under the heading of the look, I guess you could beat up on them for, beat up on this couple for being kind of stupid. But there is a couple from Oregon, a 40-year-old guy, a 37-year-old woman. They had dinner, a couple of drinks, enjoying their life at the Twisted Fish Steakhouse in Seaside, Oregon. They used a gift card to pay for, pay for their meal, but they didn't have anything, to put down on the tip. So, they slipped this envelope over to the server. With a question mark scrawled on it. And when the waitress opened it up, she found crystal meth. they're going to pay her in crystal meth. That's the tip. In fact, they found more than 17 ounces of meth in the woman's purse. You gotta wonder, how many tips they were going to leave. But, here's the thing that gets me, street value wise, would that have been more than that waitress probably made for the entire day? Since a tipped worker, their wages have been, I think it's like $2.13 an hour. They haven't raised that since the early 90s. Makes me want to think that one, we should do away with tipped employees, period, put them on a solid wage. And two, we should be raising that minimum wage up. But hey, I'm not going to beat up on the meth heads for leaving meth. At least they were in their twisted minds thinking about leaving a tip, passing a little bit of something on, even if it was kind of idiotic. Anyway, the minimum wage, there are a couple of bills, and I think Pam DeLisio pointed out one. Patty Kim has a bill. Also, Mark Cohen has a bill, which we talked to Mark a couple of days ago. About his piece of legislation, which would set a timetable to increase the minimum wage up to $11.50 an hour over the next couple of years. Now, other areas have increased the minimum wage higher. I think California, they're about, it's on the ballot to raise it to $12 an hour. Seattle's talking about raising it to $15. There's a bunch out there. But Cohen's bill would raise the minimum wage to $9 an hour after 60 days after enactment. A year and 60 days, it would go to $10.10, and 2 years and 60 days, it would go to $11.50, and then it would be pegged on the first of each year to a cost of living increase, which would then make sure that every year, if inflation goes up, your wages go up with it. So that, over the years, you don't have this erosion of wages because, here in Pennsylvania, last time they raised the minimum wage was 2006. Think about that. Here we are, it's 2014. And I don't know about you, but every time I go to the grocery store, prices keep going up. Every time I go to the gas pump, prices seem to be going up. What's not going up? That's right, the wages. But I can tell you what is. The profits and the subsidies and all of the stuff that we give to our low-wage employers. In fact, I came across the statistic. Walmart gets about $1.2 billion each and every year in tax breaks and land grants and infrastructure improvements and assistance and low-cost financing, you name it, all kind of stuff. Because, hey, we want a Walmart in our neighborhood. Not so much. They get tons of money from us. And you look at the fast food industry. Of the 7 publicly traded fast food corporations, collectively they made profit-wise almost $7.5 billion last year. They paid their executives, their highest paid executives, almost $53 million, and distributed about $7.7 billion in dividends and buybacks, and then pocketed from us as an industry over $7 billion. And you go, I think they can afford, just a thought, I think they can pay a little bit higher minimum wage. Now, had the minimum wage kept pace with productivity gains from the 1960s forward, because understand, productivity, there used to be in this country where the more you produce, the more you made. There was this kind of meritocracy that the right loves to talk about, because you know, if you work hard, you'll get some, and you'll do better, and everybody will do better. We used to believe that until about the Reagan years. Productivity has steadily gone up, and you can see it on the graph. It's going at a 45-degree angle. It's continuing on and on and on, and wages used to stay with it, stayed right around it until the Reagan years, and now not only have they flattened off, wages are actually declining. But had wages kept pace with productivity, the minimum wage would have been about almost $22 an hour, because worker productivity has more than doubled since 1968. And, you know, you think about it, had it just kept with productivity, because the meritocracy that the Republicans love to talk to us about and our business friends love to talk to us about, had we stuck with that meritocracy, $21.72 an hour is what the New York Times said. And, you know, if the minimum wage had kept pace with our wealthy elite, you know, the folks who sit in the boardrooms, the one percenters, if you will, who have seen their wages skyrocket, the minimum wage would be about $22.62 an hour. And you go, well, we could never afford that. You know, I think back to my grandfather would be saying today, we can't afford to have someone making $50-100 million a year. We can't afford to have CEOs who are lining their pockets in just the most obscene ways. We can't afford that. We can't afford to be giving massive subsidies to the corporations who are sending jobs overseas. Can't afford it. I mean, that's the thing that gets me. I love the false choices we're always given. And this idea, the Tina mentality, there's no alternative, there's nothing we can do, this is just how it is, and you're going to have to get over it. And I reject that wholeheartedly. I reject that concept wholeheartedly. Because at the end of this, our politicians, the people that we vote for while we still can vote, they're supposed to be doing our work. And when I look at what's going on and I look at all the wasted money, the waste, fraud, and abuse that these Republicans in Pennsylvania have perpetrated on we, the taxpayers, I'm angry, and I think you should be too. Think about the millions of dollars they wasted on the privatization scheme of the lottery, the privatization scheme of the wine and spirit shops, all of this wasted time, energy, and money on stuff that nobody wants, on stuff that none of my friends are saying we should be doing. You know what my friends are saying? We should fix that pothole. My friends are saying, no, I wish my kid's class was smaller. I wish the school would offer more extracurricular programs. I wish my kid's class sizes were smaller and there was more opportunity there. I wish that, you know, we had more investment in broadband internet access so that my computer doesn't run so damn slow. That's what I hear. I know Corbett has said that he talks to people all the time and says they want to buy liquor in the gas station. I have never had that conversation with anyone. I have had the conversation with a couple of people saying, yeah, I'd like to pick up a six pack at the gas station. I'd like to get that one cold beer to jump in the car and drive home with. But I you know, this stuff that's going on, I've got to be honest, I don't hear anybody in my realm talking about getting in between the bargaining of state workers and their employer and you know, this really technical Machiavellian payback. I don't hear anybody asking for it, except the Koch brothers and Alec, which last time I checked, they didn't live in Pennsylvania. Just a thought. Let's take a quick break. Right back. 1-888-520-RICK. 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up an important public worker union case later this month, Harris versus Quinn. It could result in another heavy blow to organized labor. Harvard Law professor Benjamin Sachs told Salon.com that if unions and the state of Illinois lose the case, it would devastate home care sector unions' ability to collect dues and to organize. The case is a direct attack on unions from an anti-union group. It targets a very effective tactic that unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and AFSCME are using to organize home care workers, getting governors to classify taxpayer-funded home health care workers as public employees and then granting them union rights. The case attacks the practice of automatic dues collection. Professor Stocks says the court could rule that these workers are not traditional public employees, so the dues laws don't cover them. But the conservative Supreme Court could also go further, according to Professor Sachs, and rule that it's unconstitutional in the public sector to require union dues for collective bargaining. And that, Professor Sachs says, could convert all public employees nationwide to the so-called right-to-work legal status. And he says if the current dues arrangements are ruled unconstitutional, it would dramatically hinder unions' ability to be vibrant political actors. A nationwide Cambodian garment workers' strike ended Monday following the horrific gunning down of union protesters by Cambodian military police this past Friday. At least four workers were killed, many more wounded, when the military opened fire with assault rifles during a labor protest. The strike started December 24th. Tens of thousands of garment workers were demanding higher wages in Cambodia. Unions wanted $160 a month. An offer of $100 a month was rejected by the workers, and they defied a government order to return to work by January 2nd. Since the military crushed the strike and murdered striking workers, the government has banned further labor protests. The Asia Floor Wage Alliance estimates that a minimum living wage for Cambodian garment workers is $283 a month. Cambodia's garment industry serves the U.S. and European Union markets with an annual estimated profit of more than $5 billion in 2013.
You still fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fed up?
Yeah!
Are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough. And they don't have a voice, and they're scared to step up and say, we need to change things in our neighborhood. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Join our Workers Independent News Solidarity Circle today by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Thank you. The National Labor Relations Act was a New Deal initiative which helped save American capitalism by creating a process which would protect the rights of employees and employers. This was before NAFTA, GATT, and the WTO, which tore legal rights for workers apart, moved millions of jobs out of the U.S. Yes, we stand for the workers at Boeing and Washington State. But we also stand for the workers at Boeing in South Carolina, because they will have no recourse if Boeing wants to move jobs to China. You can't say you want to create jobs here at home while destroying the rights of workers to organize, the right to collective bargaining. These are basic rights in a democratic society. You can't say you want to protect American jobs and not protect American workers. Take away workers' rights to free speech, take away workers' rights to due process, and you create a new class of slave laborers here in the United States who are helpless to stop the movement of jobs out of America.
That's a pretty amazing statement. Especially the end, a new class of slave labor, helpless. And, you look at, since the Great Recession, The jobs that have, I guess, recovered, if you will, not what I would call the greatest jobs in the world. And, you know, one of the things, I came across this survey done by the American Staffing Association. Doesn't that sound wonderful? The American Staffing Association. They're the temp agency front group. They came out with, back over the summer, this survey that showed behind Walmart, because Walmart is the nation's largest employer, behind Walmart, the second largest employer in the nation, is Kelly Temporary Services, a temp agency. And they found that at the time, you had about 2.86 million temp workers, contract workers, if you will. In fact, they found that temp jobs made up about 10% of all jobs lost during the recession, and that the average length of a temp job, about 3 months. One in 10 non-farm employers, workers were employed by a U.S. staffing firm at some point during the past year, according to their study last year, and nearly one-fifth of all jobs since the recession have been temp jobs. So you're talking about almost 20% of the jobs created since the recession have been temp jobs. And we hear this call to rebuild manufacturing, bring the jobs back. And I keep going, well, what kind of jobs are there going to be? Are there going to be more of these crappy temporary jobs with no voice, no say, no benefits, and crummy wages? I sure hope not. Here to help us talk about that is Sarah Jaffe. She's a staff writer over at In These Times. She's also co-host of Dissent Magazine's podcast, Belabored. She's written a great piece, Forever Temp. Over at In These Times. Sarah, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me back.
So you look at these numbers put out by the American Staffing Association. I love that. Isn't that a great name?
Oh, yeah.
So nice.
My favorite number, though, really, is something that's in my piece about halfway down, talking about, and this is the number that I found thanks to a professor who wrote a lovely book called The Temp Economy, Erin Hatton. And so this report from the Council of Economic Advisors, this is a government agency, found that if you take the estimated number of temp jobs in manufacturing, and because the government, let me back up a little bit, government labor agencies actually don't count temp jobs by the sector the jobs are actually in. They count them all as service jobs.
Right.
So if you adjusted manufacturing in the 90s, if you adjusted those numbers of the amount of people working in manufacturing by the amount of temps that are probably in that area, all the manufacturing job loss in the 90s would disappear. As in all the outsourcing that we think is happening, a lot of it is happening right here at home. They're just being outsourced onto a temp agency, onto a staffing agency, which makes them literally disappear in the stacks of statistics that we think we know about who's working where and for how much.
Right. So what you're saying is when you see a company leave, like say one state to go to another, they don't actually hire employers in the next place. So like when Carlisle Tire and Wheel, and I don't know this to be the fact, I'm just throwing this out as an example so my listeners have a point of reference. So when Carlisle Tire and Wheel left Carlisle, where I live, and dumped their three or 400 employees who were making decent wages, and ran down to Tennessee for $34 million in tax dollars, they could have hired a third-party logistics company to hire all their workers and have no workers themselves.
Yeah, I don't know how, you know, most of these places will still have some workers. Erin Hatton calls it the ring and core approach, where you have your sort of core workers who, you know, often will be the more skilled workers, the more long-term workers, your management, and then you have this sort of ring of temps who you can hire and fire at will. And so Nissan, when I spoke with, and I had a rather testy email exchange with a Nissan spokesman for the piece, and they say that they've never laid anyone off. And I asked, you know, does that include temps? And he never answered me. So I have to assume that, and this is the story that I got from the workers that I spoke with who work for the temp agency, that the temp workers are coming and going all the time. Some of them quit because they realize they're never going to be hired on. Others are, in fact, let go. But they claim to not have laid off any workers because they haven't laid off any people that they directly employ.
Interesting. And, you know, what bothers me is, you know, you see the president, and look, I voted for President Obama, and there's some things I agree totally with him on. But when he's running around with the guy from Amazon saying, you know, this is the model, and this is, when you look at, this is the Amazon model, just what you laid out. They've got a handful of people who work for them, and then they've got a slew of these third-party temp workers who, you know, and you know, everywhere you go, there's one of these Amazons popping up of people who are working there who are never going to get on full-time.
Right. Yeah, and I mean, this is, I mean, well, part of the focus of this piece, right, is that, like, Nissan, for instance, got a ridiculous amount of tax subsidies to move to Mississippi. The state of Mississippi gave them, Good Jobs Nation calculated it to be, I think, $1.3 billion in various subsidies, including one that is essentially the company gets a portion of the workers that it employ, the tax dollars that they pay. So they're literally paying taxes to the boss.
Yep.
So, and then this other company, Glock, right, that makes guns, which are, the company itself says that they're carried by 65% of all law enforcement personnel, right? So that means tax dollars from city law enforcement. They have millions of dollars in federal contracts with the Army, with the FBI, U.S. Marshals carry them. These people, this is, again, all of our tax dollars buying weapons for whether you agree or not with the military and the police and whatever they're doing with them. These are our dollars being spent on this. And this company is hiring skilled workers who are, like, the listing on the job site literally says you have to have, you know, experience using robotic machines. You have to be technically skilled. And they're starting them at $10 an hour, and they work for a temp agency.
Wow. And, you know, but that's the wave of the entire nation. But the question that I have is because it's pervasive through our society. And I know a lot of people who just throw up their hands and go, well, this is the only choice I've got. So given, you know, the fact that, you know, we seem to have to swallow the pill, what's the answer to this? Because look, you know, I say, well, we need to organize and join and form unions and do all this stuff. But as soon as a third party, you work for a third party logistics company, you work for the company that Amazon contracts out to, and you organize a union, they just end that contract and bring in the next temp agency to take over. So what's the answer here?
I mean, yeah, that's a really big problem. It's interesting that, you know, the Nissan plants in Tennessee and in Mississippi are in the middle of union drives. They've been having this fight for a while. Notably, you know, there are workers, one that I spoke to, Tracy Logan, who's involved in the union campaign at the plant in Smyrna, Tennessee. You know, he says that he knows he wears union pins and union, a union wristband, I think. And, you know, his bosses know that he supports the union. He's a temp. He says he gets, you know, harassed and gets, you know, constant threats that they're going to bust him back down to the assembly line. He got promoted off the assembly line to a more specific position. He's a robot tender, which is just a great job title. I think that's fantastic.
Yeah.
But he thought that getting this promotion that he had to apply for within the company, he thought that that would make him, you know, make Nissan hire him directly. It didn't. He's still a temp. He, you know, is getting a little bit more money and has a more specialized position. But so, you know, they have had a few little victories. He said that some people have gotten raises since the union started really pushing. But this has been a fight that's been going on for years. And this is, I mean, the full-time workers are not even full-time. One of my favorite bits in this story is an organizer from the Chicago Workers Collaborative who works very much a lot with temp workers said, you know, instead of calling them temp and calling them permanent employees, they call them staffing agencies and direct hire workers.
Right. Yeah.
Because it's not necessarily more permanent or less permanent. It's just who you work for, and it's just this layer of buffer between you and the company, this layer of responsibility that the company doesn't have to take for the people it employs.
And that's the other part of this, because, you know, you start thinking about this at the next level, and I
right.
always take things to the next level. What happens if you get hurt on the job? What happens if heaven forbid, you get killed on the job?
Yeah.
You know, who's responsible?
Yeah, I mean, this is a really big question, right? My colleague Michelle Chen wrote a great piece about this at In These Times, actually, about specifically the challenges of being a temp worker and who do you report to when you get hurt on the job? Do you tell your technical employer? Legally, the company that has the plant that you are on is responsible if you are injured, but, you know, it's this sort of space that people fall through the cracks in, right, all the time, because they don't know who to talk to. If they've only been there a couple of days, it's not terribly clear who they're supposed to report to. If you're there for a long time, but you still report to different people, it's really complicated. So OSHA is supposed to be looking into doing a better job of regulating companies that use, or, you know, inspecting companies that use temp, but we all know how often OSHA gets around to inspecting anything, right? Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, there's just these huge, huge gaps in our system for how we deal with this stuff. That, I mean, the workers who are direct hires are already falling through these cracks, and they're just that much bigger when you don't even really know who's boss is.
Yeah, I mean, to me, again, this is another one of those layers that creates more insecurity. And look, I know a lot of I've met a lot of people who are temp employees, and none of them are happy. But you know, you listen to the stories, and they go from temp job to temp job, and they all want that full time job. They all want that that security of working for one at one place, doing their job. And I do believe that the average worker in this country wants to be loyal to the company that they work for, and wants to have some identity in what they do. And this temp thing, I think breaks that contract, if you will.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting, right, that we used to have at least some idea that companies would invest in you if you did a good job, right? And this was, you know, it was always not as true as we'd like to believe it was true. But there was at least some expectation that if you worked for a place for a while, you would, you know, you would get your raise, you would get your cost of living raise, you would maybe get a pension, oh my God. And these things are just really not true anymore. And the really interesting thing, the sort of backbone of Aaron Hatton's book on the subject of temps, and the thing that really made it interesting to me to look at temps in manufacturing, was that these temp agencies really sold themselves back in the 50s and 60s as a way for sort of white middle class married women to earn a little extra money on the side. So it was a model that was sold assuming that women didn't need to support their family, that they had a husband to do that, and that they just maybe needed to make a little extra cash because their husband had that 9-to-5 job that would be secure, assuming you had a husband,
right?
All of these sort of very gendered expectations that we built an entire half of the workforce around this idea that there was a whole group of people who just didn't need solid, steady, full-time work because they only wanted it a little while every now and then.
Yeah.
And now those norms are creeping into this bastion of what we used to think of as good, solid, full-time, long-term, skilled work, working in the auto industry, working in manufacturing, making guns, making whatever you're making.
And
that this is now the reality for everyone.
Yeah, I mean, what used to be, you know, you pick up a day or two here or there because maybe you need, now is the reality, and this is your life. And
yeah.
I don't know that this is the way forward for an economy that is going, hopefully at some point, to regain a prosperous working class and one where the social economic ladder allows you to rise.
Yeah, no, it's not. It's very deliberately designed to not allow you to rise, right? It's designed to sort of keep you moving and shifting and needing the next job and desperate, right?
And that's the key to it, desperate. Because, you know, that's the word right there. And thinking of all the people that I've known who've worked these temp jobs, it's that desperation where they go in and they kill themselves every day until they wear themselves out. And then 3 months, you know, that number stuck out to me from the staffing association, that the average temp job is 3 months long, because that's about the burnout rate of
right.
You know, just killing yourself to try and impress and get a job. And then they just move next. Interesting.
Yeah.
So I guess the finish this up. I mean, what's the answer? What do we do? I mean, is there a political answer to this? Is this a societal answer? Any thoughts in what you've researched?
I mean, there are a lot of political answers. There are a lot of societal answers. I mean, you and I both agree that we, you know, worker organizing is always a big part of that. But there are legislative victories that the Chicago Workers Collaborative specifically has had some wins on the state level and on the local level. But they're really, you know, and some of these things too, like these companies that are getting government contracts, hi, we could maybe not give millions of dollars in tax money to companies who are creating terrible jobs. There are things that can be done sort of immediately on that level that has been pointed out many times over the last several months, especially by the folks at Devos who did, Amy Traub did a wonderful job on a report on the low-wage jobs that are being subsidized with our tax dollars.
Yeah, what we want to use our tax dollars to raise conditions up?
Right.
What? We don't want that.
We could do that. We could pass some laws. We could make sure that temp workers have the right to organize. We could keep pushing for these like new OSHA regulations to make sure that temp workers are being treated the same as anybody else who gets injured on the job, as in they should have be able to see a doctor right away. I don't know, things like weird little things like that.
So there are
a lot of things we could do to make this better, but the key is we sort of have to do a lot of things to make it better, because just one passing a law isn't going to do anything. One workplace having a union isn't going to fix the problem. It's a big, big problem, yeah. And it's a one that's just getting bigger, and we really have to actually be aware of it to fight it.
And for me, it's one of those things where at some point you hope there's enough. There's only so much of you know what people are willing to eat, and we push back against it. Again, the article, Forever Temp, Once a Bastion of Good Jobs, Manufacturing has Gone Gaga for Temps, written by Sarah Jaffe over at In These Times. We've got a link at therickssmithshow.com. Just click on Sarah's name. Sarah, always great talking with you. Appreciate the time.
Thank you.
Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
One of these days we're going to wake up.
Changing America for the better.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at therickssmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
January of 1964 was a time to remember for many Americans. The Beatles released their first album. New York announced plans to build a World Trade Center. The Surgeon General announced smoking kills, and President Lyndon Johnson declared a war on poverty during his first State of the Union address. January 1964 was also a momentous year for the American truck drivers. The nation's truckers saw the first nationwide labor contract. The National Master Freight Agreement, covering some 450,000 truck drivers employed by 16,000 companies across the country, set a nationwide minimum wage of $3.33 per hour, or $23.63 in 2008, as well as providing health care and retirement benefits for all its members. The 1964 National Master Freight Agreement set a nationwide standard for working conditions, giving drivers a voice on the job and the power to stand up to abusive treatment, and eventually the ability to refuse to drive equipment the driver deemed unsafe. Led by labor visionary James R. Hoffa, this victory was the crowning achievement of the International Brotherhood of Teamsters as one of America's most influential unions. This landmark agreement created a framework for all national contracts to follow. Jimmy Hoffa, the man who famously quipped, "I may have many faults, being wrong is not one of them," was certainly right about the benefits, power, and influence of such a national agreement for workers, both union and non-union. Wages and benefits earned by truck drivers brought millions of hardworking men and women solidly into the middle class by rewarding hard work with a fair day's pay for a fair day's work. For generations, the National Master Freight Agreement served as the industry standard for all truck drivers, raising wages, improving benefits, and providing a safer workplace for drivers and the motoring public. Unfortunately, since the 1980 passage of truck and deregulation, the industry has resorted to cutthroat competition based on who is willing to work for less. In this environment, the National Master Freight Agreement has lost some of its power in lifting truck drivers out of low wage, no benefit, and hazardous conditions. Currently, many non-union truck drivers are earning at or near poverty poverty wages while pushing legal limits. For many truckers, their pay is solely determined by the number of miles they drive. Breakdowns, time spent waiting to be loaded and unloaded, and other delays are shouldered by the driver, in most cases without compensation. 1964 and the years that followed has shown what can be accomplished by workers standing together. Perhaps the future will see resurgence in worker solidarity and the reemergence of a fair day's work, a fair day's pay. This Rick Smith Show Labor History Moment is brought to you by a grant from the Labor Education Center at IUP. For more information, go to www.therickSmithShow.com.
Keeping the chambers of commerce within their gated communities. The Rick Smith Show.
You can't tell me we're gonna make it somehow. I heard a wise man say revolution starts now. I think it's time for change.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something in your mind, you can email me, Rick@TheRickSmithShow.com, or give us a call here at the studio, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. Our quote of the day from Tiberius Gracchus. Yes, Tiberius Gracchus, the 2nd century B.C. Roman politician who said, you know, and it's true. I mean, it's as true probably then as it is now. You can't call yourself rich until you can afford your own army. And, you know, you look at the wealth class and how much money they put into arming politicians with lots of money and, well, the militia, the military, our police force, because heaven forbid, you know, those workers, they rise up. And what's interesting to me, and you know, I go back to, and I guess I get hung up on history and things of the past that catch my attention. You know, you think about Smedley Butler and the War is a Racket pamphlet that he wrote back in the 30s, and all of the money that we've spent on our military misadventures overseas so that we can have a wealthier wealth class. And what do they turn around and do? Well, they turn around and they make things that much worse for you and me. And I think about these temp jobs, you know, and the reality, when you have the second largest employer in the country, a temp agency, you kind of got to wonder what's wrong with your economy. You know, when at one point, and you go back to, you know, and I talk about my grandparents' generation a lot, General Motors was the largest employer in the country. Manufacturing was a huge part of what we did. And those were good-paying union jobs that paid a solid living wage. It was hard work. It was grimy, dirty, sweaty work. But you made a living, and a good living, with something of a retirement and health care and all of the things that built the middle class, that built a prosperous working class. One that made people look to the future. You know, I look at the jobs that we have now, and we're so much further technologically advanced than they were then, and we're so much more intelligent and have so much more education, yet we're so much more insecure. And I look at my kids, and I worry like hell about what kind of country my kids are inheriting. Is every job they're ever going to get going to be one of these? Well, you'll be here for a week. Don't get used to it. But here's your paycheck. Good luck next week. That's what we've allowed to prop up. It just, well, it makes me wonder. But it also makes me wonder how much of it we're willing to put up with. At some point, do we say enough is enough already? And demand. You know, much like they did during the Depression, demand through the threat of people, listen, heads on sticks, that conditions get better. We shall see. Quick break. Right back with hour three of the program. If you missed any portion of the program thus far, RickSmithShow.com, Stitcher on the smartphone. Back after this.
Nation.
Rick Smith Show.
You are listening to The Rick Smith Show on WIOO 97.9 Carlisle and 93.9 Shippensburg. We're back live in the studio tonight and every weeknight from 9 to midnight. Got something on your mind? Give us a call, 1-888-520-RICK. That's 1-888-520-7425.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up an important public worker union case later this month, Harris versus Quinn. It could result in another heavy blow to organized labor. Harvard Law professor Benjamin Sachs told Salon.com that if unions in the state of Illinois lose the case, it would devastate home care sector unions' ability to collect dues and to organize. The case is a direct attack on unions from an anti-union group. It targets a very effective tactic that unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and AFSCME are using to organize home care workers, getting governors to classify taxpayer-funded home health care workers as public employees and then granting them union rights. The case attacks the practice of automatic dues collection. Professor Sachs says the court could rule that these workers are not traditional public employees, so the dues laws don't cover them. But the conservative Supreme Court could also go further, according to Professor Sachs, and rule that it's unconstitutional in the public sector to require union dues for collective bargaining. And that, Professor Sachs says, could convert all public employees nationwide to the so-called right-to-work legal status. And he says if the current dues arrangements are ruled unconstitutional, it would dramatically hinder unions' ability to be vibrant political actors. A nationwide Cambodian garment workers' strike ended Monday following the horrific gunning down of union protesters by Cambodian military police this past Friday. At least four workers were killed, many more wounded, when the military opened fire with assault rifles during a labor protest. The strike started December 24th. Tens of thousands of garment workers were demanding higher wages in Cambodia. Unions wanted $160 a month. An offer of $100 a month was rejected by the workers, and they defied a government order to return to work by January 2nd. Since the military crushed the strike and murdered striking workers, the government has banned further labor protests. The Asia Floor Wage Alliance estimates that a minimum living wage for Cambodian garment workers is $283 a month. Cambodia's garment industry serves the U.S. and European Union markets with an annual estimated profit of more than $5 billion in 2013.
You still fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fed up?
Yeah!
Are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone, everyone in my community. I live in the south side of Chicago, and it's rough, and they don't have a voice, and they're scared to step up and say, we need to change things in our neighborhood. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Join our Workers Independent News Solidarity Circle today by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Where smart policy and sound investment matters. The Rick Smith Show.
So you wake up in the morning, get to work and fight yourself. And then somebody tells you that you're owned by someone else. So what's it all about? It's money! Work it out!
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. So if you looked around the corporate-controlled, for-profit conservative media, you'd look and you'd go, wow, the 50 years of the war on poverty, an utter failure, a horrible failure, huge mistake. We just took a whole boatload of money and threw it down a hole and lit it on fire and put acid on top of it and burned it, and it was worthless. And I'm here to tell you that's absolutely wrong on every front, in my view. But here to help us work through it, I've asked Mike Consul. He's a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. He's also written an interesting piece over the New Republic, The War on Poverty Turns 50, Three Lessons for Liberals Today. Mike, thanks for taking time for us.
Hey, thanks for having me on.
So if you look at fake news on Fox, you look at a lot of the conservative websites and all this stuff, the whole war on poverty and helping poor people, the idea that we could eliminate poverty was an utter, absolute failure.
Yeah, it's crazy. You know, it's funny. There's a whole industry of conservative intellectuals who are putting forward numbers that are just not true or, you know, kind of purposely inaccurate. If you include the actual things we do to try to boost people's wages and keep them out of poverty, things like the earned income tax credit, things like food stamps, it actually does a really good job of keeping people out of poverty. It does especially good job of keeping people out of extreme poverty where they have very little money. And does a great job at reducing poverty among children where poverty can be very deadly and very, you know, very difficult for their entire life chances. So it's actually a pretty remarkable, especially given the amount of resources we put to it, which is not much. I mean, if this, you can tell that this is not an actual war because we can always fund an actual war
right.
in the country. But the funding we throw to it is nowhere near a challenge. But the money we do does actually get really good results. And there's a whole industry about people just trying to deny this fact.
Yeah, but you know, but if you listen to it, all I keep hearing people say is it was we've wasted all these trillions of dollars and it did no good. And you know, I look at myself as the example. I'm a kid who grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. If it's not for food stamps, if it's not for Section 8 housing, if it's not for educational opportunities, if not for a lot of the Great Society New Deal programs, I have no idea where I am or what costs I am to society.
Exactly, and you know, one of the three lessons I ask people to keep an eye on, and you were talking is watch the way conservatives talk about the war on poverty, because the war on poverty is actually, it's really expanding Social Security, which conservatives are not talking about. I mean, elderly poverty in this country was a major epidemic, with 60% of elderly people were in poverty in 1960. Now it's less than 10%. I mean, it's a remarkable achievement,
yeah.
all because of the stimulus program of Social Security. Medicare, things like Head Start, things like Pell Grants for colleges. These are all parts of the war on poverty. But what they want to do is demonize, essentially, unmarried moms, which is, you know, how we...
My mother.
They coded welfare as this one thing that they could demonize. Not only is actually all this stuff that is really popular and has huge support, no matter how much they try to dismantle it.
But, you know, what I keep hearing, though, is it's especially from the personal responsibility conservatives who are against making people have health care. But they're out there saying this was about controlling people, keeping people on the dole and keeping people down and repressing people. And I think of myself, I'm going, I guess I missed that.
Yeah, it's crazy. If you actually look at the numbers for, say, EITC, which is, you know, I don't want to over-exaggerate. I mean, it's a solid program. It's going to be much better, to be much more generous. People are on it for a few years. You know, you find people have a hard time at some point in their lives. Maybe they have a kid, so their income is very strapped for a very small period of time because they can't work as much as they want to or as much as they could. Or, you know, you have periods where, like, the Great Recession, where there's a huge amount of unemployment. And so that spending is not only just like good from a moral point of view, it's also good from a, you know, a spending point of view because it gets money in the economy spending when people aren't investing. So, I mean, I think it's a very popular and a very useful and effective group of tools that we have to fight poverty. Conservatives are just constantly trying to argue, that there's not much there. Now, on the other hand, it's also a matter of jobs because what you see is that both in the 60s and then also in the 90s when they dismantled a lot of welfare, there's a presumption that people can always get a job so everything will be okay. And in the 90s, you had a pretty decent job market. Now we don't. So, you know, you dismantle welfare, then there's no jobs. It's very difficult for people to get by.
If I remember right, in talking about the EITC, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is something that Ronald Reagan called one of the best pieces of legislation ever, one of the best job-creating pro-family pieces of legislation ever to come out of Congress.
Yeah, I mean, it comes out of the early 70s after there was a huge debate in the 60s about whether or not to guarantee minimum income. And the thing about, you know, the EITC is it is the reason why the 47% in Mitt Romney's famous declaration from the 2012 election to his donors are the 47%. It means that, you know, there's a group of people who will not pay federal income taxes, but instead get support through federal income taxes. So they essentially get money back from their federal taxes, which boosts them out of poverty. It's a very effective way to get money to people. But it creates this kind of meme that really sets conservatives on edge. And it's remarkable because you think they would try to push it because, you know, the EITC, you know, you have to work to get it. So it forces people into the workforce. That's a very beneficial thing from an employer's point of view. It's why you want things like minimum wages or other kinds of benefits to complement it, to boost workers' powers and give them other sources of income. But it's remarkable how weirdly agnostic, like, they're hypercritical, but there's often not an actual there to the solutions or their ideas stuff when it comes to the conservatives on poverty.
Yeah, it's interesting to me. And if I remember right, the EITC was a Milton Friedman idea, correct?
Well, close. Hugh originally actually proposed something that would be even more beneficial.
The negative income tax.
Negative income tax just means you'd have a guaranteed income even if you didn't work. And he wanted to do a lot of things. He wanted to dismantle a bunch of programs. But interesting enough, that's not the process he wanted it. You know, there's a very old meme, you know, a story Michael Katz called it, the undeserving poor. And that there's a real long tradition within trying to provide aid about people, you know, essentially trying to decide who's deserving and who's not. And then you get a lot of really ugly morality with a lot of that stuff. Something like a negative income tax is very interesting because basically everyone qualifies for it. Where the welfare system we ended up with, you know, has a lot of surveillance, it has a lot of kind of stigmatization, where, and this is the thing I really try to emphasize in the piece, if you look at things that are more conducive to rights, things that everyone gets to enjoy, everything, programs that are universal, things like Social Security and Medicare,
right.
I mean, no one's stigmatized for taking Social Security. Everyone loves it. Everyone relies on it. They're going to rely on it more when these 401ks don't pan out. So, you know, having programs a little bit more like that, I think is the way forward, and when we kind of try to think about how we can keep people prosperous in the 21st century.
Yeah, I mean, because I keep asking the question that, you know, since we're propping up the low-wage workforce with things like EITC and food stamps and LIHEAP and all of these programs that the right likes to demonize, shouldn't we be talking about, you know, making it for everybody that is in this low-wage economy or make them pay proper wages where people could afford the things on their own?
Exactly. I mean, the idea that, you know, if you are working right now, then, you know, you are perfectly fine. That is certainly not the case right now. And, you know, a lot of the growth in employment right now is very low wages. And, you know, that's just a way the economy is rolling. So we either find a way to help people one way or we find ways to give workers more power, either through unionization, minimum wages, tighter labor markets. Ideally, you can do some combination of both. I think that's the best for everyone. But, you know, You know, when Republicans are just say, you know, go out there and get a job, or, you know, even a lot of conservative Democrats back at welfare reform, that's a big problem when unemployment was over 10% a few years ago. It's a big problem with unemployment over 7% right now. And, you know, if that is your argument, you know, go get a job, that's a big problem if there are no good jobs and the jobs you can find will not support you and the family.
You know, I look at fake news on Fox. They had one of the headlines, they said, you know, 50 years on and poverty won. You know, I look at that as, you know, poverty didn't actually win. I don't know that you're ever going to alleviate it completely, but we made people's lives better. And I think when you bring it back to the individuals that were helped by it, I don't know that you can on any level argue that it was a failure. I mean, again, I guess I internalize this because of the station that I grew up in and where I am now. And because of all of these programs, I was able to get that helping hand to move forward. And I know so many people who, like me, were able to make that climb forward and become productive members of society who paid back and all of that stuff. So I don't know that you could ever call it a failure.
Exactly. And if you look at the programs that particularly help kids in these situations, things like, I don't know if you benefited from Head Start or Medicaid, or, you know, a child tax credit, but those things, you know, are actually really popular. I mean, they, you know, people often talk about the idea that programs for the poor make for poor programs, but if you look at things that actually benefit families and benefit children, they're very popular. And, you know, like SCHIP and the expansion of Medicaid is, you know, very popular with a lot of voters. And so I think those are the kinds of things you could expand and build out and make more solid in a way that I think would be very helpful. And you see right now with de Blasio in New York pushing for universal pre-K, President Obama's brought it up, and you're going to see a real fight for that. And that's the kind of thing that really will make a difference in people's lives.
Yeah. You know, on Monday you saw the anniversary of FDR's Four Freedoms speech and the Second Bill of Rights speech. Today you've got the 50th anniversary of the War on Poverty. Looking forward, you know, the mission's not done. The Second Bill of Rights, not so much. The War on Poverty, not won. I believe we need to be redoubling these efforts to shore up the bottom and really create a more prosperous working class. I mean, we've done a great job of creating an incredibly prosperous 1%. Now I think it's time to start looking after the rest of us.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the other thing about welfare reform in particular, but even the War on Poverty in some ways, if you look at it, is that they kind of assumed that the rising tide was going to lift all boats, so you just had to get people in the marketplace, and they had different ideas about how to do that. But we're right now seeing an economy where, you know, growth is primarily going to the top 10% of people, top percent of 10% of income earners, particularly the top 1% of the 1% of the 1%
right.
Of income earners. So it's, you know, that it's good that the economy is growing, but it's terrible the distributional consequence. So you need things in place, taxes, a better labor standard to really force that growth to be equitably shared.
Now, I'm in favor of going back to the great socialist president Dwight David Eisenhower. Go back to his tax code. Bring me that back, and you hear people squealing and quite loudly, and I don't know that it ever happened, but start. There's a good place to start.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we can certainly we've had taxes much higher than we've had right now, and the economy was doing great. I mean, you had higher growth, and you had a much more equitable distribution of income, and that didn't just happen. That was a result of labor movements, as the result of all kinds of other things in the economy that, we're looking at and we're not sure if we're going to get right now. I mean, I think the conversation is healthy right now. I'm subtly encouraged by things like the campaign to expand Social Security with people like Elizabeth Warren behind it. I think that the direction is pointing in the right direction. I think it's just a question of how far we can move along.
Yeah, so my last line of questioning then is, outside of, pieces like yours, which is fantastic, and other folks who are saying, like me, saying, the war on poverty, maybe it's not won, but it's certainly not lost. How do you begin to push back against the megaphone on the right to say, oh, it's a failure, we just chucked a whole bunch of money down a fire pit, and it was a waste? How do we push back against that?
Well, I think the first thing is to try to encourage people to have an expansive definition of what the war on poverty is. I mean, President Obama tried to cut spending in Medicare through reforming the program in Obamacare, and it was the loudest megaphone on the right was they were taking your Medicare, right? But that's the war on poverty program. It's explicitly a war on poverty program. It's to prevent medical costs from overwhelming the elderly. So when people think of the war on poverty, they think of welfare, and it's so racially coded, and it's so coded against the poor, and it's very difficult to kind of unring those bells with people. But if you include them to think, well, actually, it's Social Security making sure people are, your grandparents are not in poverty. It's making sure poor people and the elderly have health care. It's Head Start. It's education. It's job training. It's a whole, bucket of policies designed to really, increase the living standards of our worst off. I think that's one way to disrupt it in a way that's useful. And also point out the way forward, because there's a reason those programs are popular, because they're broadly shared and people expect to use them at some point in their lives, or someone who will have used them at some point in their lives.
Yeah, and you can't come around. Like, I still remember the Reagan years and the welfare queen, and I remember thinking, man, that wasn't my neighborhood. I don't know where this welfare queen is. They never did find her, though, along with the small family farmer who lost his farm because of the estate tax. Never found that guy either. But I remember thinking there was nobody like that in my neighborhood.
No Cadillac?
No Dom Perignon, no steak, no diamond rings, none of that stuff. There was poverty and misery and empty cupboards at the end of the month. That's what I remember as a kid. But a great piece, Mike. Of course, the piece is titled The War on Poverty Turns 50, Three Lessons for Liberals Today, written by Mike Konzel, fellow over at the Roosevelt Institute. We've got a link at thericksmithshow.com. Just click on Mike's name. Mike, always great having you on the program. Appreciate it.
Thanks for having me on, man. Take care.
All right, let's take a quick break. Right back, 1-888-520-RICK, 1-888-520-7425. This is The Rick Smith Show.
Uncovering the con in conservatism. Rick Smith.
Hey there, fellow working class heroes. I have some great news. You can now get the Rick Smith Show podcast on your iPhone, Android, BlackBerry, or Palm on demand and on the go. Get your class war to go by downloading the Stitcher app on your smartphone by going to Stitcher.com and search for the Rick Smith Show, or go to our website at thericksmithshow.com and click on our Stitcher button. Together we can, and we will, rebuild a prosperous working class and leave opportunity for our children.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand-name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then, they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org. To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Waving the flag of freedom for people, not corporations. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, thericksmithshow.com. So, you know, under the heading of knowing your enemy, and look, the reality is, folks, none of these right-wing governors like Tom Corbett or Scott Walker or Rick Perry or Snyder or Scott or Paul LePage, for that matter, none of these people have the back of working people. In fact, the Maine governor on Tuesday released some data that he decided we're going to go and evaluate the waste, fraud, and abuse in the EBT system, the electronic bank transfer system of the TANF cards. So they went and they looked at all of the transactions, and they came up with more than 3,000 transactions that were either done at bars, sports bars, and even a couple done at strip clubs. Mm-hmm. Because they have ATMs in these strip clubs, and they found them. There are people who go to strip clubs and get money out of their account at strip clubs. Now, understand, you're talking about, there are 3,000 of them. And without getting into the what-ifs and possibilities, first let's look at the magnitude of the problem, because to hear the right-wing talk, waste, fraud, and abuse is just rampant. There's a welfare queen around every corner. In Maine, there are about 50,000 transactions of these EBT cards each and every month. So in the time period that they were looking for, which was January 1st of 2011, when he took office, until November 15th of 2013. So over that two-year span, there had been some 1.8 million transactions. So according to the Bangor Daily News, that makes up about 0.2% of the total purchases and withdrawals being classified as waste, fraud, and abuse, or just abuse. 0.2%. And I got to be honest, as I was thinking about this, do you think Visa or MasterCard, or Discover, or any of the credit cards, do you think they would like to see 0.2% of fraud or abuse? Do you think they would like to see that? You bet your sweet bippy they would. But here's the other part of this. You go and you start thinking about, okay, you see these ATMs in bars, you see these ATMs in strip clubs. Oh, strip clubs! Think about where, I don't know, you know, and I think back to the neighborhood that I grew up in. there really wasn't a bank in my neighborhood, much like there wasn't a grocery store in my neighborhood. You think about poor areas, urban areas, where you've got blight, where you've got high poverty, where folks who would be using these EBT cards are. Do you think possibly that the strip club that the ATM was used at, do you think possibly that was the only ATM around? Do you think maybe the person using the card to feed her kids may have worked at that club? Do you think possibly, maybe, instead of demonizing, do you think it possible? No. We don't want to think about that. We simply want to point fingers. We simply want to make people think there's all this waste and all this fraud, and those people are just squandering it on booze and on cigarettes and on candy. Like the idiot who wrote a piece a couple years ago. I got my $99 for the month of food stamps, and I went and bought $99 worth of candy. Okay, good for you, ding dong. What did you eat for the rest of the month? Because understand, it was a college kid who did it, who had a meal plan at school. Somehow he lied his way into getting food stamps, and this is the scam that I'm going to make a big piece for myself. Understand, these are very real people who are struggling. And, you know, I go back and I can't help but think about my childhood. I can't help but think about the situation that not just me, but most of my friends, what each one of those families were going through. And, you know, to me, this kind of nonsense only shows me another reason why these radical right-wing governors have to go. Now, according to LePage, he wrote, "This information is eye-opening and indicates a larger problem than I initially thought." So he thought it was 0.1%? Because it's 0.2%. You're talking 3,000 out of 1.8 million. And even of those 3,000, like I said, I'm sure you could find the vast majority of those being, it was the only ATM in the neighborhood, and maybe the people actually worked at those places. But he goes on to write, "These benefits are supposed to help families and children and the most vulnerable Mainers. Instead, we've discovered welfare benefits are paying for alcohol, cigarettes, and other things that hardworking taxpayers should not be footing the bill for." Now, the Bangor Daily News asked his spokeswoman about the small number of transactions, and her response was, "Well, any amount of abuse in the system takes away from the truly needy to deal with it." She said, we're not uncovering anything new. There's always been bad actors out there. And we're simply saying, we've got an eye on you. And I'm going, really? I wish more voters would have an eye on LePage. This is the guy you may remember who jumped in with the Romney 47%. Well, you know, 47% of Maine people, they don't pay taxes. You know, kind of along the Romney thing, even though, according to the Bangor Daily News, 65% of the people in Maine are actually actively working and seeking jobs. And I guess you got to ask the question, where do you go to school? Because when I went to school, 65 and 47, that didn't make 100, but, you know, is what it is. And he, you know, went on in 2012 to say that, despite the high unemployment rates, those lazy people should get off the couch and go get a job. Now, remember, this is from the guy whose first act, is one of his first official acts as governor, was to tear down the workers' mural in the state. So the other day, another Paul LePage moment, since we're going to look at the Corbett clone, he was giving a speech at the 73rd annual Maine Agricultural Trade Show. And he said, you know, we don't allow children to work until they're 16. But 2 years later, they can go to war and fight for us. That's causing damage to our economy. I started working earlier than that, and it didn't hurt me at all. There's nothing wrong with going to work at age 12. And, you know, okay, you know, is that where our economy's taken? Where now the 12-year-old's got to go out and help feed the family? You know, I go back and I talk about myself. You know, I had two paper routes. I got up in the morning, early in the morning, delivered the morning plane dealer. In the evening, delivered the Cleveland Press. shoveled snow, cut grass, did all of those things. Did it teach me work? Did it teach me responsibility? Yeah, maybe. But it was out of necessity more than out of want. It was out of necessity that we didn't have food to put on the table more than, oh, it just taught me good life lessons. What work at age 9, 10, 11, and 12 got me, chipped tooth, couple of stitches, that kind of stuff. And, to be honest, I don't know that it really did all that much for me to begin with. It would have been nice to be a child. But you've got this movement. You've got these people who glorify kids going, or put them back in the mines, put them in the looms, or as Newt Gingrich said, let them clean the toilets. Get rid of those union janitors and put those kids to work cleaning toilets. That's the mentality of our conservative leaders in this state and in this country. Sad stuff. Quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk. 7 years and I'll go to work at night.
Making the blue blood see red. The Rick Smith Show.
You're listening to WIN, Workers Independent News, a production of Diversified Media Enterprises. I'm Doug Cunningham. The U.S. Supreme Court will take up an important public worker union case later this month, Harris versus Quinn. It could result in another heavy blow to organized labor. Harvard Law professor Benjamin Sachs told Salon.com that if unions in the state of Illinois lose the case, it would devastate home care sector unions' ability to collect dues and to organize. The case is a direct attack on unions from an anti-union group. It targets a very effective tactic that unions like SEIU, Unite Here, and AFSCME are using to organize home care workers, getting governors to classify taxpayer-funded home health care workers as public employees and then granting them union rights. The case attacks the practice of automatic dues collection. Professor Stocks says the court could rule that these workers are not traditional public employees, so the dues laws don't cover them. But the conservative Supreme Court could also go further, according to Professor Sachs, and rule that it's unconstitutional in the public sector to require union dues for collective bargaining. And that, Professor Sachs says, could convert all public employees nationwide to the so-called right-to-work legal status. And he says if the current dues arrangements are ruled unconstitutional, it would dramatically hinder unions' ability to be vibrant political actors. A nationwide Cambodian garment workers' strike ended Monday following the horrific gunning down of union protesters by Cambodian military police this past Friday. At least 4 workers were killed, many more wounded, when the military opened fire with assault rifles during a labor protest. The strike started December 24th. Tens of thousands of garment workers were demanding higher wages in Cambodia. Unions wanted $160 a month. An offer of $100 a month was rejected by the workers, and they defied a government order to return to work by January 2nd. Since the military crushed the strike and murdered striking workers, the government has banned further labor protests. The Asia Floor Wage Alliance estimates that a minimum living wage for Cambodian garment workers is $283 a month. Cambodia's garment industry serves the U.S. and European Union markets with an annual estimated profit of more than $5 billion in 2013.
You still fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fired up?
Yeah!
Are you fed up?
Yeah!
Are you ready to fight?
Yeah!
We stand today not because we want more money. We want justice today.
It's always the same story, even back when I started, 76. Less men, more coal. That's what they want.
I'm fighting for everyone. Everyone in my community. I live in south side of Chicago, and it's rough. And they don't have a voice, and they're scared to step up and say, we need to change things in our neighborhood. We all need to come together. Workers all around the nation.
Workers Independent News puts workers and their unions on the national radio news airwaves every day. To help keep labor's voice on the air, go to laborradio.org.
Join our Workers Independent News Solidarity Circle today by donating at laborradio.org. You've been listening to WIN, Workers Independent News. For more information, visit laborradio.org.
Most important issues of the day. This is the Rick Smith Show.
So yesterday, New Jersey Governor Chris Christie held his ceremonial signing of the New Jersey Dream Act that will give undocumented students in the state of New Jersey the ability to pay the lower in-state tuition rates. I think it's the right thing. I don't know why it had to be a big ceremony. I guess, you know, propping them up for the 2016 presidential run, courting the Latino community. But today, you know, because it was good news yesterday, today not such a great news day. Turns out that whole George Washington Bridge scandal was out of his office. And as one New Jersey politician noted, either he's clueless or he's a liar. And you pick your choice. Anyway, here to help us work through some of that and some of the other goings on of the day across the nation and across the globe, I've got Alan Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Alan, thanks for taking time for us.
Well, thank you.
So clueless or liar?
Well, you know, it was interesting. We had a debate in our office. I said, if Christie could be found to be a liar on this, I think he's finished. And two people in my office said, "Oh no, he's not finished." I said, "Oh yes, he is."
Do you think people who would be drawn to him care? Do you think they? Because I know people who
he might be able to get the Republican nomination, okay. But he sure as heck, I don't think, could get the general, because somebody like Hillary Clinton would run as saying that, "How can you trust this guy? He's going to be another Nixon."
How can you trust him? Because he's going to back up the worst bridge in the country.
That's right.
That just seems cruel to me. Because as someone who has had to go over that bridge numerous times in my life, and anybody who's ever had to go over the George Washington Bridge,
I do all the time.
It is a nightmare during the day. It could take you 4, 5, 6, 10 hours to get across that bridge.
Yes, it can. It's crazy, that bridge.
So where's this going to? I understand the offending party fell on the sword and resigned. Where do you see it going from here?
Well, if the offending party fell on the sword, resigned, and there's no other data that comes out that he knew this, that Chris Christie knew about this, the incident goes away. If there's more emails or something else that ties him to it, it is a continuing story.
Yeah.
It will have legs, as they say in the business.
You can only hope. Because, you know, you like a good scandal every now and again to deflect people's attention from how badly they're getting screwed by this economy. And I look at this fight over the unemployment. I cannot believe that it's taken this long and that it seems to be this difficult. But I guess it's not surprising from a party that's held the nation hostage for the last several years. This whole idea that people who are struggling, we're going to demand the pounds of flesh, not just a pound, but pounds of flesh for a meager 3-month extension just blows my mind.
Well, yes. And the other question is whether, you know, John Boehner is just digging his heels in the sand on this and just saying no, no matter what, is he going to extend that?
Yeah,
that's a big problem.
It is a big problem. But, you know, to me, again, this goes back to we need to be voting these people out.
Well, yes, but since you and I don't live in the great state of Ohio, we've got problems voting these people out. Now, can we try and change all of Congress? That would be a good thing.
And I would like to see him not be Speaker. What I thought was interesting is Boehner said that he was waiting for a plan from the president. And, you know, maybe it's just that I remember my high school government class where legislation, you know, comes from Congress and the president signs it. I don't quite know where all of this, we're looking for the president to give us our homework.
Well, I don't know either, but I think that it is very clear that Republicans got people to, or Democrats got the Republicans in the Senate, 6 of them to vote with them. And but I don't know, you know, Boehner could not bring something up in the House, and then they would need what's called a discharge petition to bring it up in the House. And clearly they don't have enough votes to do that.
And really, at the end of all this, and you know, I've said this a number of times over the last couple of years, what we actually need is a full employment policy. We need jobs plans. We need the next New Deal, the next war on poverty, the next war on unemployment, if you will, to get people back to work. You know, I'm not a huge fan of extending unemployment indefinitely. Get people back to work. Get jobs. Make government the employer of last resort. That's always been my view.
And many people, including some conservatives I know, don't disagree with you and think that we've got to do more in terms of training. Jim Pinkerton from Fox has been talking a lot about doing cures in medical enterprise zones and really using what America does best, which is medical innovation. But, you know, you've got to have a Congress that can get out of its own way.
Yeah, but at the end of it, it comes down to somebody's got to have the bowl of cat food that the cats come running to. Someone's got to make that demand. So in order to, because, you know, this whole idea that if you continue to give tax cuts to these businesses, they're going to create jobs is ludicrous, and it doesn't even make sense in a common sense world. Only in the political world does that seem to make sense. If we give people a boatload of money, then they'll have nothing else to do with it but create jobs. Where I'm saying we take that money and we have some demand. Say we want stuff. We want roads, bridges. We want buildings. We want new widgets and whatnots and all of that stuff. Here, go do it.
Well, certainly. I mean, yes. And what's so interesting is that even in the Senate, the Democrats want to pay for this employment by simply taking money away from these tax loopholes. And the Republicans in the Senate are saying, no, 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 if we're going to do, let's take it from immigration, children of immigrants. Makes no sense.
Yeah.
Close the loophole.
What's interesting to me is here we're on Monday, it was the anniversary of FDR's Four Freedoms speech, the second Bill of Rights speech that he gave, saying that people should be free from fear and free from want and free to speak and practice their religion and all of that. And then, you know, today you've got the 50th anniversary of the war on poverty. What I think are just great movements forward. These last couple of years seem to me to be, well, I'm pretty much most of my adult life from the Reagan years forward have been taking us backwards away from those two ideals. I'm curious your thought.
Well, yes. I mean, they've taken them. I mean, I think some of us have still had those ideals, but you've had a government that has not been able to develop a plan. I mean, even something as simple as fixing our infrastructure, which would create jobs, and which I know there have been Democrats who have been really trying to come up with a plan to do that, and you can't get it through Congress.
Yeah, I mean, it's just...
Infrastructure, bridges that are falling apart. This is not rocket science.
Or broadband, high-speed broadband. I mean, we're pathetic. In the rest of the world, we're the laughingstock, and we pay out more than anyone else for poorer service.
You know, I remember in 1999, I worked for a group. We were contracted with them called Radio Wall Street, and they sent me to an event where they showed how China is going to broadband their whole country. And then I come back, and I hear the Senate arguing whether cities and towns should be allowed to put in their own broadband. Well, of course they should be. But there were people who were supporting the bid to telecom that didn't think they should be.
Yeah.
It doesn't move America forward.
Yeah, I mean, I often wonder what if we didn't have, you know, I go back to the Electrification Act, I go back to, you know, putting telephones all over and all the movement to move us into the 21st century back years ago. And if we could do those kind of big things again. And I fear that we're so gridlocked that we can't do big things anymore.
Well, we're not going to be doing big things, and we're sure as heck, you know, it's interesting.
Can't even do the little things.
Chris Christie and cutting off the traffic on the George Washington Bridge, but they didn't even bother to fix the bridge. And you don't want a big bridge like that in disrepair.
Yeah, I, as someone who has driven over that a number of times in a big truck, I would not want to make that fall. And finally, the book, every conservative's screaming about the book, Obama's a failure, and Bob Gates didn't like the book. Of course, the book, Duty, Memoirs of a Secretary of War, by this former Defense Secretary. What have you been hearing?
Well, of course, beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, and so is this whole thing, honestly. I've basically been hearing a lot of the same, you know, the same kinds of things that we've been seeing in the press, and particularly at the White House today. But what we've mainly been hearing is Bob Gates contradicts himself throughout the book. And so I'm not giving a lot of what he says credence to sort of what he says. That Hillary Clinton and the president that took their position on the surge is just because it's the primaries, or I can't give a lot of weight to what he said because he does contradict himself.
Yeah, and you got to wonder how much of it was, hey, we just need to sell books. You got to say something that's going to stir the pot.
Well, maybe. You know, I did the first and the second sort of broad brush edit, not the final edit on Bob Ney's book. And there were some places that I felt he was a little contradictory, and I said, please explain. So I'll give some grief to the edit process.
Yeah, but, you know, one of the things, the quotes that I have seen that I think is spot on, and when he's talking about Congress, he says that they're uncivil, incompetent at fulfilling their basic constitutional responsibilities, micromanagerial, parochial, hypocritical, egotistical, thin-skinned, and prone to self and re-election before country.
Well, that may be true, but I don't think he's unique in saying.
That's like the pot calling the kettle black, then.
Right, exactly.
I did want to ask you one more thing. I know you're intimately involved with what's going on in South Sudan. What's going on, and how are the folks that you work with, how are they faring?
Well, I was able to get 11 students out of South Sudan. One had been in a UN compound for a long period of time, for 3 weeks, and left literally with the clothes on his back. So I'm going to greet them all in Grenada on Sunday. So I was delighted to get them out of South Sudan. But I do know this, that the United States position has changed just a bit. Originally they were totally backing Salva Kiir, the president, and because there has been some words about ethnic cleansing and some other things, they're now saying they're not taking a position. At least that's what they're saying privately. Publicly they may be saying they're supporting the elected president, but I think that the United States is pulling back a little of its support for Salva Kiir, and if that happens, honestly, I think this other group may take over. And we actually spoke to them today, and they said that they are interested in having elections. So we'll see. Salva Kiir did not have elections, and he was elected president, but then when it became a separate country, he should have immediately called for elections for a new country and did not.
Yeah. Well, I hope things work out, and I know you're intimately involved there, and you have a vested interest in the people there, and I wish them nothing but the best.
Well, I'll keep you informed of what's going on that front.
Appreciate it, Ellen. Thanks so much.
Okay.
Great talking with you. Ellen Ratner, Talk Radio News Service. Let's take a quick break. Right back. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
The Rick Smith Show, changing America for the better.
Tenacity can be a virtue, but the persistent push by giant food conglomerates to deceive us consumers has turned their tenacity into raw mendacity. Brand-name food peddlers are spending hundreds of millions of dollars on lobbyists, lawyers, campaign donations, PR hypesters, and political manipulators so they can genetically and dangerously alter the dinner we put on our family tables without bothering to tell us which items they've messed with. With practically no public notice, their first deception was to get Washington to okay the production and introduction of genetically modified organisms into corn, canola, soy, and other crops. Then they quietly pushed to prevent federal regulators from requiring that these tampered Frankenfoods be labeled as containing GMOs. Next, they tried a grand deception, insisting that foods tainted with GMOs qualify for the national organic label. Even our usually submissive regulators balked at that one. But look out, for here they come again. Big Foods Industry Front Group, the Grocery Manufacturers Association, is now demanding that foods with genetically engineered ingredients be allowed to use the word natural on their packages. Natural? Let's see. One, these biotech mutations are not products of nature, but of corporate technicians. And two, the plants are manufactured in corporate labs by extracting genes from a foreign plant or even an animal, then splicing those genes into the manufactured creature. The very DNA of this man-made food is altered, with no understanding of the long-term environmental or health consequences. This is Jim Hightower saying, a Twinkie is more natural than that. They're perverting both our language and nature's reality. To oppose these profiteers' tenacious mendaciousness, contact the Environmental Working Group. That's at www.ewg.org.
To get more of Jim Hightower's populist take on what Wall Street and Washington are up to, visit www.hightowerlowdown.org.
Officially in love with Michelle Bachman, even if she's batshit crazy. Rick Smith.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Check out the website, TheRickSmithShow.com. Questions, comments, something on your mind, you can email me, Rick, at TheRickSmithShow.com. If you missed any portion of the program, download the podcast there at the website, or get Stitcher on your smartphone. Take the program on the go. Interesting goings on the other day. A guy named Christopher Schaefer, he is a member of the Church of the Flying Spaghetti Monster. Yes, he is a Pastafarian. He was sworn in as a member of the Pomfret, New York Town Council. And yes, he was wearing the colander on his head. Tinfoil hat? No, not so much. Just a colander. It's not the tinfoil, but, you know, it is what they were told. Now, under the tinfoil hat section, you may remember people saying, you know, they can spy on you through your laptops, and they're collecting data on you on the internet. And, well, now we find out, actually happening. A story I came across the other day pointed out that the NSA, there's actually a program that they've got that is doing just that to your laptops. It puts some kind of spyware and malicious hardware on the machines that reroutes your laptop. And they're also saying that your smartphone, they have the ability to turn the camera on, have the ability to listen in. I guess you got to ask the question, didn't we already know? And I know, but Rick, if you're not doing anything wrong, why does it matter? Yeah. Speaking of tinfoil hats, speaking of, I guess, just kind of weirdos, Dennis Rodman, and we talked about him on the other day, about his outburst on CNN to this Chris Cuomo guy, where he, you know, basically, and this is kind of weird, I don't know why you would go into attacking this Kenneth Bay guy who's being held and I guess sentenced to 15 years in a labor camp there because he intended to topple the government. Rodman blew off into this rage against the guy on CNN. Basically said, do you understand what he did in this country? Do you? No, you tell me. That's why he's being held here in the country. Why? They're saying maybe he was on drugs. And would that be a stretch? Would that be a... No, probably wouldn't be a stretch. But the sad thing is that this could be our chief diplomat in North Korea. John McCain yesterday said of Rodman, it's a mixture of almost feeling sorry for the guy because he's so stupid and a little bit outrageous. Representative Elliot Engel, the Democrat from New York, likened Dennis Rodman wanting to play basketball in North Korea to Adolf Hitler, inviting him to lunch. So there you go. Very, very strange. Now, Jay Carney, the White House spokesperson, told reporters that Rodman hadn't contacted the U.S. government prior to his trip. Carney went on to say, I'm not going to dignify that outburst with a response. Simply going to say that we remain gravely concerned about Kenneth Bay's health. You know, I think about this and I go, you know, what exactly is Rodman doing over there? Really? Kim Jong-un is my friend? I love him. Wow. Worm. Yeah, I guess. Sure. Interesting email from John. He says, Rick, I'm not sure if you saw this. I just wanted, just before Christmas popped out, wanted to make sure you did. He sent me this story about a minimum wage story, because he knows I'm big into promoting minimum wage. This one was a woman who worked at a gentleman's club. And I'm sure he sent it because I just talked about, you know, the Paul LePage bit. Because, you know, those people with the EBT cards, they were using it at strip clubs. They were getting their food stamp money and the SNAP benefits at strip clubs. Well, here's this ex-dancer who worked at a gentleman's club. We don't call them strip clubs here. We call them gentlemen's club. Evidently, she filed a lawsuit just before Christmas, claiming that she was denied the minimum wage and forced to live on tips, which, you know, you go through and you look at this going, well, $2.13 an hour if you're a tipped employee might qualify you for food stamps. Now, if she had one of these EBT cards and used it at the place of her employment, would Tom Corbett or Paul LePage say, see, fraud and abuse? No, this is where the woman works. Now, you know, I think she's got an interesting argument here, because the strip club, or the gentleman's club, classified her as an independent contractor, and, you know, according to her, did it on purpose, intentionally misclassified her so that they wouldn't have to pay any federal minimum wage laws or overtime or anything. Because she's saying, you know, they were working, you know, 40, 50, 60 hours a week, and for each shift that they worked, they had to pay the house $25. And she said, you know, if she was having a good night, you know, you tip the disc jockeys $10, insisting that the club's fee constituted an illegal kickback. Now you go back and you think of, you know, how much do you make in 5 or 6 or 7 12-hour shifts? And I think about, you know, the guy from Wisconsin who, you know, people want to work 7 days a week. I'm not so sure. But here again, you know, you stop and you look at this stuff, kind of makes you wonder. How far have we allowed things to get out of hand? This is what business friendly has bought us. And I know, liberty of contract, if she didn't want it, she should have taken the job. Here's the sad reality. Here's the wake-up call. Most people take jobs because they don't have a choice. Sorry, I hate to burst the bubble, because I've had this conversation with a number of folks over the last several years. So, well, you know, if I didn't like it, I would leave. Do you like your job? Well, no, not really. Then why don't you leave? Can't find another one. You know, it's convenient to point the finger. Not so convenient to look in the mirror. Interesting gun story. A Democratic state representative in Kentucky, Leslie Combs, evidently was unloading her gun in the Capitol when, oops, it went off. The bullet hit the ground, stuck into a bookcase. You know, one of her staffers happened to be in the office. When I first read the story, I'm going, well, how do we know she didn't shoot at the staffer? And that was just the argument. Now, the Democratic state representative, Jeff Greer, he was in the room, wasn't injured, along with the staffer. Combs explained to reporters on Wednesday, I don't want to use it anymore. I thought it was totally clear. I'm a gun owner. It happens. The Speaker of the House there in Kentucky is asking the police to investigate the incident, and maybe hold her accountable. And on a positive note, today is the day that Gabrielle Giffords was shot, and that horrible incident in Arizona. And to commemorate, to remember that incident, she successfully completed a skydiving trip, which, you know, you think about it, just 2 years ago, well, I guess that was 3 years ago, wasn't it? Yeah, 3 years ago today, you know, here was a woman who was near death. Couldn't, and then you moved down the road, couldn't speak, couldn't walk. The recovery path, amazing for her. But I also remember the folks, the six people who died in the attack. So we'll take that and finish up tonight. We'll see you back here tomorrow. Have a great night.
been listening to The Rick Smith Show. Together, we can make America better. Email Rick at TheRickSmithShow.com or interact with us anytime at TheRickSmithShow.com. Until next time, this has been The Rick Smith Show, where working people come to talk.
It's coming like the tide of flood beneath the Buddha sway. Imperial, mysterious, and amorous rage.